Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Like all of the institutions today, the institution of medicine, people use the institution of medicine to support the white supremacist idea. And they did that by coming up with theories of differences between blacks and whites that explained why whites were superior. So the medicine, the role of medicine, one of the roles, I don't want to say the only role, but one of the roles of medicine was to establish a scientific reason for the difference between, for treating slaves the way they treated them. That is, that they deserve to be treated that way. Physician defined slaves as biologically different from whites. They defined black people as biologically different and invented slave diseases to explain slave behavior. So if you were a slave who ran away too much, they thought you had a disease called drapomania, because obviously no slave in their right mind would run away from a good master. If you had pain caused by the heavy burdens and kicks of the masters, that you were just sick, because they call it difficult patronition. Some enslaved people would eat dirt, and it was because of a nutrition deficit and lack of feeding, but that was seen as a disease of the slaves, of enslaved people. And then they did outright, so first of all, that's where we start. And we have to start with, I love to talk about Dr. Rush, because Dr. Rush was he signed the Declaration of Independence. Benjamin Rush was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and is known as an abolitionist. Okay, so this has to make us understand that even white people who articulate things that are supposed to be for our benefit may be doing it from a position of white supremacy. And you have to look at their reasoning underneath, not their behavior. Because if you don't look at their reasoning underneath their behavior, then you might end up befriending them in a way that ultimately causes you harm, because they really are white supremacists in their nature. And I think Dr. Benjamin Rush was one of those people.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's day, Friday, April 29th, 2016. So I have been told. That was Professor Bernelia Randall. She's been a four-time guest on The Cows. That was from her visit in August of 2009. First time she spoke with us, we discussed her book, Dying While Black, which has just excellent information and suggestions on things that black people can do to combat counter racism in the health care industry, including what to do if you're going to have to make a visit to the doctor's office, hospital, that sort of thing. Excellent, excellent point that she made in that exchange right there. I thought that was really important and ties nicely into the section of medical apartheid that we're going to discuss this week. She continued. I just didn't play the whole thing with Dr. Benjamin Rush and talking about how he was allegedly a good white man for this period in time. But she goes on to talk about how he also concluded his diagnosis, if you will, was that black people have a mild form of leprosy based on our high concentration of melanin, kinky hair, and big noses. Anyway, you will see how that fits in with this week's segment of Medical Apartheid, Harriet A. Washington. We will go ahead and get started. She's picking up talking about how folks like Benjamin Rush, Samuel A. Cartwright, racists of the day, how they made all of these racist medical analyses so that they could justify abusing black people under the guise of science. We'll proceed. Context of White Supremacy, Medical Apartheid, audio segment number one.
Other medical disorders were thought to manifest differently, usually less severely, in blacks. Syphilis, for example, was held to be racially dimorphic. Physicians believed it worked its most feared damage within the neurological system of whites, but that the less evolved nervous system of blacks was left relatively unimpaired. In blacks, syphilis was thought to attack the muscles, including the heart. This belief that syphilis in blacks differed dramatically from the disease in whites provided a rationale for the infamous U.S. Public Health Services, PHS, Tuskegee study of syphilis in the untreated Negro male. Between 1932 and 1972, 600 black men, their wives, and their children were deceived into participating in a research study that denied them treatment, so that PHS scientists could trace the progress of the disease in blacks. In an 1850 paper, Cartwright insisted that whites and blacks differed so dramatically that the same medical treatment which would benefit or cure a white man would often injure or kill a Negro. This universal belief in uniquely black diseases led doctors and planters to clamor for a textbook on the medical care of blacks, but such a book was not written until almost a century later. When it appeared in 1942, it was no paean to white superiority, but rather was entitled The Biology of the Negro, a text edited by African-American physician Julian Herman Lewis. It was followed in 1975 by the masterwork Textbook of Black-Related Diseases by Richard Allen Williams, M.D. Allegedly inferior cognition was only the tip of the iceberg. In 1854, several years after Cartwright published Report on the Diseases and Physical Peculiarities of the Negro Race, and 5 years before Darwin published On the Origin of Species, Mobile, Alabama physician Josiah Knott, M.D., and George R. Glidden produced an equally popular screed entitled Types of Mankind. In it, they claimed that blacks' physical and mental differences signaled their polygenic origins and proved black inferiority. For example, Knott theorized that the distinctive knee joint and long heel of the black man proved he had been created as a submissive knee bender, a servant to whites. Scientists adjudge the dark skin of Africans as a biblical curse that set them aside as eternal servants to other men. Black Americans were thought of as a race that was biologically identical to the African race, and there originally was some logic to this, because 20% of slaves were still Native Africans in 1780, although that number dropped to only 10% by 1830, a few decades after slave importation officially stopped. Mulattoes, the progeny of black-white matings, were considered to be a separate race. According to ethnologists of the American school, blacks' features marked them as a different species. Large buttocks and genitals that indicated hypersexuality. A head covering that was not hair, but analogous to the wool of livestock. The size of the skull, determined by painstaking but rigged measurements. The prognathous facial angles of blacks, and thick lips that testify to their ape-like nature. Had scientists of the era more correctly noted that apes and chimpanzees have the thinnest of lips, they doubtless would have ignored this feature before they credited blacks with such an evolutionary advance. Physicians discovered many imaginary physical differences in blacks, such as fingernail anomalies, a distinctive topography of the breasts, elongated penises, disproportionately large hands and feet, distended labia and clitorides, all of which provided scientific racists with ample evidence of black biological primitivism. In fact, few anatomical sites escaped persistent labeling as definite indicators of black inferiority. As late as 1903, Dr. W.T. English observed, "A careful inspection reveals the body of the Negro, a mass of imperfections from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet." Even biological advantages were cast as racial flaws. In discussing the tendency of blacks to survive yellow fever epidemics that killed whites, one physician denounced the inferior susceptibility of black slaves. Insidious immunities. Polygenism, the belief in separately evolved species, also held that persons of one race could not survive in the climate designed for another. Whites who tried to live and work in West Africa, a climate putatively designed for blacks, died in droves, earning it the sobriquet "white man's grave," when the 19th century death rate for British soldiers ranged between 483 and 668 per 1,000 soldiers in Africa, compared to the general annual death rate of 15 per 1,000. Historian Warwick Anderson, M.D., describes how the U.S. military sought to exploit the natural affinity of black Americans for the tropics. In 1900, Nathaniel Southgate Shaler, the dean of Harvard's Lawrence Scientific School, proposed that the troops which are required for federal service in tropical lands might well be recruited from the Negroes. Shaler was convinced that such children of the tropics would make excellent soldiers, at least as infantrymen, because the African-American constitution was pre-adapted to the tropical disease environment. But in the Philippines, Shaler's distinguished advice was already redundant. During the previous 2 years, the United States had been using African-American and Filipino scouts to suppress the resistance to its occupation of the archipelago. Physicians claimed that whites could never work in Africa or in subtropical environments such as the U.S. South. The Southern landowning class, including physicians, paid attention because they equated disease with a sinister climate and were confronted with an oppressively hot and humid, malarious environment that they believed to be teeming with yellow fever, smallpox, pellagra, typhoid, dysentery, and cholera. They were also faced with fertile lands that required back-breaking labor, with the attendant risks of heat prostration, sunstroke, and parasitic infestation. An immune population specially designed by the Creator to work long, hard, and for free as submissive knee-benders was the perfect answer to their dilemma. In mid-century, Samuel A. Cartwright and his medical brethren, such as Charles Laibach, belabored the immunities to malaria and yellow fever they claimed blacks exhibited. But to fully justify enslavement, scientists such as Knott had to turn from their naturalists' texts to their Bibles, from which they deduced that blacks were the children of Ham, son of Noah, who, along with his progeny, was marked and condemned to be servant to his brothers for having viewed his father's nakedness. Other similar biblical justifications were found, and Knott even ventured onto a twisted ethical high road when he insisted that yellow fever and malaria were visited upon whites as divine punishment for not enslaving blacks. He insisted that non-slaveholding whites contracted these diseases as a result of usurping the natural black role as laborers in the fields. Pragmatic planters and politicians ignored the religious moralizing, but embraced the useful fact that black slaves were the only logical medical choice for backbreaking labor in their sunny fields. The immunities in question were usually partial and sometimes imaginary. Planters' own records bear the best evidence that blacks' immunity to heat prostration was merely a convenient myth. One Virginia owner observed in 1825, "Hottest day ever. Men gave out and some fainted." The 1851 journals of K. Washington Skinner, overseer on the Gowrie plantation, noted, "On Monday last, Cotta and Sari received a stroke of the sun. Many of the other Negroes staggered about considerably." Blacks were supposed to be immune to malaria, but such immunity is complex and was poorly understood before 1900. Malaria denotes a group of lingering infectious diseases marked by long cycles in which waves of utter debility alternate with periods of better health. These periodic relapses can end in death. Depending upon the strain of malaria and the immunological vigor of the sufferer, the disease is spread by parasites injected by the bite of the female Anopheles mosquito, and at the time, it was widespread outside of New England, especially throughout the South. However, 18th and 19th century Southern physicians did not understand that malaria, which they called intermittent fever, remittent fever, fevers in ague, or quotidian fever, actually has three different strains, with differing causes, symptoms, and prognoses. Falciparum and vivax malaria are the most common North American strains. Another strain, malariae, is so rare and so similar to vivax that scientists tend to consider them a single entity. Vivax malariae, which antebellum physicians called tertian fever, causes racking symptoms of high fever, chills, headache, icy bone pains, anemia, profuse sweating, and exhaustion, many of which recur at 48-hour intervals. It can become chronic and last for years, but it kills only 5% of its victims. Falciparum malaria ends more quickly, but it is much more severe and can cause a stroke by compromising the blood flow to the brain and kidneys. 40% of its victims die. In 1826, Dr. Philip Tidyman wrote, "Intermittent fever, so hostile to the constitution of the white inhabitants, has no terror for the Negro, who, when attacked, requires but little medicine to rid himself of this insidious enemy and to secure him against a return." However, planters' records and physicians' journals are full of accounts of slaves laid low with or dying of malaria. It was an extremely common complaint, one that coincided inconveniently with harvest times in the late summer or the early fall, so it was a serious monetary concern to planters, who were willing to expend money on physicians to get their malaria-stricken slaves back into the fields as soon as possible. The scientists were wrong in positing Africans' innate, absolute resistance to malaria, and they were equally wrong in suggesting that whites could mount no immunity. Anyone, black or white, who grows up in a malarious area and survives repeated infections and bouts with falciparum, comes to live in an uneasy truce with the parasite, becoming not quite well, but not acutely ill. This state of immunological compromise misled planters into thinking that these slaves were unaffected when they were exposed to falciparum malaria and did not die. Such immunity is temporary, lasting only as long as one remains continually exposed to the falciparum parasite. Planters and physicians knew this and deliberately cultivated local malarial immunity in their newly arriving slaves by seasoning or allowing them to be bitten by area mosquitoes, thus infecting them with the local strain. Whites underwent seasoning as well. However, one type of malarial immunity is racially distributed in the United States. 95% of sub-Saharan Africans and approximately 70% of African Americans are Duffy negative. This means that they lack the Duffy antigens, without which Plasmodia vivax cannot penetrate red blood cells and cause illness. People of any ethnic group who have sickle cell trait, possessing a single gene for sickle cell anemia, also enjoy a partial protection against deadly falciparum malaria. So do people with one gene for the related blood diseases, or hemoglobinopathies, thalassemia, hemoglobin S, and hemoglobin C. These are not black immunities. They also protect Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, and Asian peoples. Interestingly, the contradiction of the black slave as both riddled with imperfections from head to toe and as a hardy laborer who was impervious to most illness escaped the scientific racists. The scientists expressed whichever opinion fit their political needs at the moment. As abolitionist Frederick Douglass suggested when he observed that 99 of 100 polygynists were Anglo-Saxon slave owners. Scientists also claimed that the primitive nervous system of blacks were immune to physical and emotional pain and to mental illness. This belief, which will be discussed at greater length in the next chapter, released physicians and owners from the responsibility of shielding black slaves from painful medical procedures and justified torture such as branding, whipping, hobbling, and maiming. All these precepts of scientific racism, although convenient for the slave owner and physician, were highly illogical articles of faith. So was the supposed inferior intelligence of blacks, because planters and doctors behaved in many contexts as though they held the abilities and judgment of blacks in high regard, employing slaves in responsible positions as nurses, cooks, herbalists, midwives, overseers, leaders of work gangs, accountants, and operators of farm and factory implements. Owners reaped profits from the many patents on slave inventions, and physicians used slaves as skilled apprentices, who often went on to practice independently. White households depended upon the specialized skills and discernment of slaves, not the other way around. In descriptions of runaways, published as newspaper advertisements, a master's financial interests necessitated an honest description of his vanished slave. These are replete with references to artful, well-spoken, crafty, and intelligent slaves who typically absconded in well-organized groups, often with a light-skinned Confederate who posed as their owner until they reached freedom. Advertisements refer to some slaves not only as literate, but as polyglots fluent in French, German, and Dutch. Some were refined violinists and declaimers. Others practiced professions such as doctor or dentist. The master's plaintive wonder that an apparently docile slave should have given him the slip is a commonplace of these advertisements. The dearly held precepts of scientific racism sound nakedly racist, absurd, or both today. But in the 18th and 19th centuries, scientific racism was simply science, and it was promulgated by the very best minds at the most prestigious institutions of the nation. Other, more logical medical theories stressed the equality of Africans and laid poor black health at the feet of their abusers, but these never enjoyed the appeal of the medical philosophy that justified slavery and, along with it, our nation's profitable way of life. Dr. Gardner, whose slave market narrative opened this chapter, spoke for many when he claimed that slave owners must have jealously guarded their slaves' health, coddling them to protect their own economic interests. In the Washington slave pen, Gardner witnessed the physician in his role of pronouncing a slave to be sound. Yet he confused the physician's certification of the slave's soundness with concern for her health. Soundness did not speak to her welfare or happiness, but rather to the ability to extract work from her, the likelihood of fetching a good price on the market, and her breeding ability. Many common medical problems, from mental illness to chronic malaria and parasitic infection, were compatible with the demands of an enslaved laborer's work. In fact, many ailments emanated from these workloads. Profit drove the medical treatment of slaves from their very first encounters with Western medicine. Kidnapped Africans en route to the Americas were cursorily examined by ship surgeons in an attempt to cut losses by immediately jettisoning those with such stigmata as Winterbottom sign, a swelling of the lymph nodes found in those who harbored trypanosomiasis, or sleeping sickness. They and others who would not survive the horrific Atlantic journey were unceremoniously thrown overboard. Southern physicians engaged in a bustling soundness practice by guaranteeing the fitness for work of slaves who were to be bought and sold. Doctors charged as much or more for this service as they did for standard disease treatment. A simple pronouncement of health, for example, could cost anywhere from $2 to $10 in 1850s Virginia. But such assessments were sometimes challenged when the slave died or became incapacitated soon after having been pronounced sound. Expert physicians' testimony commanded as much as $50, a very steep one-day fee for the times. Thus, testifying to soundness in court became an important and lucrative part of medical practice. And in 1858, Dr. Jeriah Harris of Savannah Medical College declared the need for a manual that cataloged the chronic or debilitating diseases that rendered blacks unsound for work. He then, cannily, supplied the manual himself. Among the deal-breaking ailments it cited were loss of limbs, cancer, asthma, rheumatism, debilitating injury to muscles, keloid scars, and syphilis. How was this interest in fitness for work or soundness at odds with slave health? With the soundness rather than the welfare of the slave in mind, for example, slaves were not immunized against smallpox as whites were, because this might leave marks on their bodies that could discourage buyers. The memoirs of William Wells Brown, originally a slave and later a doctor, recount how the graying hair and beards of aging slaves were blacked on the auction block. They were subsequently purchased by buyers who expected the toil of a young man. But blacks countered with ruses of their own, as slavery apologist Edward A. Pollard illustrated in 1859. Noe, on mounting the steps to the auction block, had assumed a most drooping aspect, hanging his head and affecting the feebleness of old age. He had probably hoped to have avoided a sale by such a dodge. Former slave Bethany Veeney recalled in her memoirs, "I had been told by an old Negro woman certain tricks that I could resort to, when placed upon the stand, that would be likely to hinder my sale. And when the doctor, who was employed to examine the slaves on such occasions, told me to let him see my tongue, he found it coated and feverish, and, turning from me with a shiver of disgust, said he was obliged to admit that at that moment I was in a very bilious condition." Veeney did not disclose the specific advice the old woman shared, but many common therapeutics of her day, such as the emetic calomel, dramatically inflamed the tongue, gums, and salivary glands, Veeney continued. "One after another of the crowd felt of my limbs and asked me all manner of questions, to which I replied in the ugliest manner I dared. And when the auctioneer raised his hammer and cried, 'How much do I hear for this woman?' the bids were so low I was ordered down from the stand. And Eliza, a beautiful woman, was called up in my place. Poor thing! There were many eager bids for her, for such as she, the demands of slavery were insatiable." Soundness for women, and sometimes for men, was tied to sexual attractiveness and to reproductive ability. Thomas Jefferson declared, "I consider a slave woman who breeds once every 2 years as profitable as the best worker on the farm." Every year from 1750 until emancipation, one of every five black women of childbearing age, between 15 and 44, gave birth. Girls were forced or enticed into sexual relationships at an unhealthy early age by owners who cited the girl's supposedly hot-blooded African nature. Sexually transmitted diseases thrived on the plantation, notably syphilis, against which the immunologically naive Africans had little protection. Enslaved women's vulnerability began on the sea passage from Africa, as recorded in the 1788 memoirs of English ship surgeon Alexander Falconbridge. On board some ships, the common sailors are allowed to have intercourse with such of the black women whose consent they can procure. The officers are permitted to indulge their passions among them at pleasure, and sometimes are guilty of such excesses as disgrace human nature. But whites ascribed black women's sexual availability not to their powerlessness, but to a key tenet of scientific racism. Blacks were unable to control their powerful sexual drives, which were frequently compared to those of rutting animals. This lack of control made black men dangerous and made black women sexually aggressive Jezebels who habitually enticed white men into inappropriate sexual relations. Dr. Louis Agassiz, the famous Harvard ethnologist, explained, "As soon as the sexual desires are awakening in the young men of the South, they find it easy to gratify themselves by the readiness with which they are met by colored, mixed-race house servants. This blunts his better instinct in that direction and leads him gradually to seek more spicy partners, as I have heard the full blacks called by fast young men." This theory did not allocate any responsibility to the master as the owner of the women and the person who decided when and with whom she would have sexual relations. But slave narratives bemoan the rape and sexual abuse that threatened a black woman at every turn. Mary Reynolds, who was born on the plantation of Dr. Kilpatrick in Black River, Louisiana, reflected, "Us niggers know the doctor took a black woman quick as he did a white, and took any on his place he wanted, and he took them often." As the personal property of the master, black women had no social or legal protection. They could not legally be raped. Even consensual relationships had to be viewed through the lens of enslavement. In her memoirs, former slave Harriet Jacobs sadly mused that she eventually acquiesced to such sexual demands because it was less humiliating to give in than to be forced. Once pregnant, women typically were kept at hard labor until their fifth month, and recalcitrant pregnant women were made to lie in trenches that accommodated their bellies so that they could be beaten without harming the unborn child. Soundness considerations also dictated levels of care, which varied according to a slave's value. Slaves who were strong, young, and valuable received a quality of care that was denied to the feeble as well as to the aged, who were often cast off the plantation or sold to physicians when the expense of their care exceeded their market value. Former slave Martha Griffith Brown recalled the words in which an abusive master refused to pay a doctor to treat an elderly slave who had spent her life working on his plantation. "I ain't going for to spend money on that old nigger unless you cure her and make her able to work and pay for the money that's been laid out for her. If she be going to die, why, let her do it in the cheapest way." The Owner-Physician Pact. Southern physicians supported the slave system with racial medical theories and diagnoses, but the slave system also supported them. In an era when physicians enjoyed considerably fewer financial rewards and lower professional status than they do today, these physicians derived most of their income from caring for slaves. As Samuel Cartwright observed in 1853, "The most profitable kind of practice is that among Negroes." Slavery created a medical partnership between physician and planter that eclipsed the patient-physician dyad, the traditional Western healing relationship. In the slaveholding United States, where the planter owned the slave and employed the physician, owners made their complaints or treatment wishes known to physicians and gave or withheld consent for procedures, from sterilization to amputation to autopsy. The planter, not the slave, had to be satisfied with the results. The planter, in every important sense of the word, was the patient. The Southern relationship was a slaveholder-physician dyad, with the slave left outside, unconsulted, uninformed, and with no recourse if she or he was unsatisfied, injured, or killed. a medical non-entity. Physicians were often slaveholders themselves. In fact, an 1847 state medical convention in Alabama issued a recommendation that doctors caring for slaves seek liens upon the human chattel if their bills were not paid. Slave-owning physicians profited from their slaves in the usual ways: fieldwork, housework, concubines, rented labor, and breeders of slaves. However, doctors also bought and hired slaves on whom to conduct experiments too painful, too risky, or otherwise too objectionable to inflict upon whites. I will examine many instances of this practice in the pages that follow. The matter of life insurance also illuminates the medical conflict between a slave's health and his master's economic interest in his soundness. Although most Southern gentlemen found the prospect of insurance coverage for land-owning whites and their families a distasteful parallel to insuring equipment and livestock, the practice of insuring slaves' lives escalated in the 1840s. In 1858, 75% of the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company policies were written on slaves. But despite owners' assurances that their slaves were like members of their family, insurers' research suggested that owners did not shy from maximizing the profit from their slaves, dead or alive. Even Dr. Josiah Nott, the famous defender of slavery, worried that rapacious masters would allow sick or injured slaves to die without treatment, warning, "Any man who will drive a horse cruelly will drive a Negro or operative to death, if he can gain anything by so doing." South Carolina and Virginia insurance companies eventually refused to insure a slave's life for full value for fear that owners would allow them to die of their ailments. Insurers also hedged their bets by requiring physical examinations of slaves, by charging more for slaves placed in especially hazardous assignments, and by requiring proof that the owner had had the slave treated for medical conditions as they arose. Thus, companies that have lately taken heat for insuring slaves' lives also took steps that protected those lives. I spoke in my introduction of iatrophobia, a term for the fear of medical care that joins the Greek words for healer and fear. Black iatrophobia has a very long history, and one of its earliest signs during slavery was that when they were not accusing slaves of malingering, overseers, planters, and physicians complained bitterly that slaves were concealing their illnesses. In this, they were often correct. Slaves avoided the ministrations of Western doctors by denying that they were sick as long as they could, even to the point of working while they were ill, discarding medications, and hiding their children's sickness. This enraged masters and physicians because they believed that blacks' failure to report illnesses and to accept white cures led to premature death and the loss of valuable slaves. However, slaves distrusted Western remedies as ineffectual and dangerous. They also complained that these treatments were stereotyped. The same remedies were offered for various ailments. Mary Reynolds could list her physician owner's entire materia medica, the common term for pharmacological supplies, for slaves in one breath. "Dr. Kilpatrick gives sick niggers ipecac and asafoetida and oil and turpentine and black fever pills." Work Projects Administration interviews quoted former slave Joe Hawkins as charging, "Doctors then didn't doctor a person like they does now. No, sir. He'd bleed you so many minutes while he watched his big watch he always carried. Bleed you from most any sickness." Slaves knew that some of the treatments worsened problems, and, perhaps most important, they realized that a master's interest in their fitness for work was sometimes inimical to their health. In short, enslaved blacks often eschewed Western medicine because they suspected their owners of a greater interest in them as capital than in their welfare. They also questioned the acumen and the motivation of the regular Western practitioners, who, in turn, ridiculed the spiritual component of African medicine as superstition. Then, too, slaves had their own healers and preferred medicines that were less harsh and often more efficacious. Slave medicine, unlike the physiology-based, almost mechanical ministrations of whites, incorporated African healing philosophies and techniques, including strong psychological, social, and spiritual components. Slaves themselves illustrated this by the parallels they drew between their medical treatment and that given the livestock. Former slave Richard Toler remembers that owners were as particular with slaves as with the stock. That was their money, you know. And if we claimed being sick, they'd give us a dose of castor oil and turpentine. That was the principal medicine colored folks had to take. And if we was real sick, they had the doctor for us. Appeals to God, the importance of moral fitness, and enlisting the help of departed spirits, especially the intercession of ancestors, were all key to the African-based healing process. Ancestors who were angered by disrespect or neglect could cause illness, alienation, and other troubles for the living. This is one reason the respectful ritual treatment of the dead was so important to slaves, and why they reviled Western medicine when they discovered that physicians appropriated the bodies of dead slaves for display and dissection. Western medicine was thought ineffective against spirit-caused illness, and slaves often lacked confidence in a Western doctor's ability to cure them. If a doctor did not believe that one could be cursed or conjured, how could he remove the threat? This is a wide generalization, because some slaves mistrusted African practitioners, who sometimes used their skills to harm as well as to heal. But in planters' farm books and in medical journals, physicians and slave owners repeatedly berated the ignorance and superstition that led slaves to conceal illness and to shrink from scientific Western medicine in favor of conjure women and witch doctoring. However, whites had no monopoly on science. The African tradition involved physiological as well as spiritual approaches to healing, including an encyclopedic knowledge of herbs, roots, and other natural medicaments. This detailed knowledge was continually passed down along lines of apprenticeship from wise women and male herb doctors to gifted young members of the community. Despite their characterization as primitive, African healers first employed citrus juice for scurvy and inoculation for smallpox and other viral illnesses. Midwives used African techniques, herbs, and medicines so successfully, without dangerous tools of the day, such as forceps, that many white women called them to attend births. Some whites were impressed by the success rate of Negro doctors and doctresses, consulted them, and placed their medication recipes in the family book, and Western doctors faced brisk competition from black herb doctors. In an 1855 journal article, Dr. R.H. Whitfield of Alabama railed against unscientific midwives. "There are no practices wherein which the female practitioners are less educated, being chiefly negresses or mulatresses or foreigners without anatomical, physiological, and obstetrical education. That such uneducated persons should be generally successful is owing to the fact that in a great majority of cases no scientific skill is required, and thus a lucky negress becomes the rival of the most learned obstetrician." For all their complaints, physicians in the early to mid-19th century were happy to leave the business of birthing in the hands of black midwives. However, physicians wanted black healers under the scrutiny and supervision of white physicians. White doctors denigrated black midwives and healers, calling them uneducated. But white physicians themselves usually had no academic preparation beyond a few months in proprietary medical school or a few years of apprenticeship, which many blacks also shared. So until the mid-1800s, such claims of superior education rang hollow. Also, regular medicine embraced no consistent curriculum, but roped in a motley association of disciplines. At the bedside, healers practiced a variety of Western fads, such as hydrotherapy, which utilized harmless but ineffectual water cures for many ailments, and Thompsonism, followed by disciples of New Hampshire farmer Samuel Thompson, who, like black healers, advocated the use of milder herbal and vegetable remedies and emetics. The constant friction between white physicians and enslaved healers sometimes erupted into open hostility. Physicians denigrated black medical practice and imposed punishment, including execution, upon black healers, on the pretext of protecting the larger community from poisoning and from the evil machinations of occultists who, doctors claimed, controlled the minds and actions of superstitious blacks. Black contributions to early American medicine included research. In fact, slave doctors sometimes developed medications that were so highly prized as to garner them fame, fortune, and their freedom. In 1729, Lieutenant Governor Gooch of Virginia authorized the payment of £60 to Manumit, an unnamed Negro man. Gooch declared that his mixture of pharmacologically active roots and bark had proved an effective syphilis remedy. "It is well worth the price of the Negro's freedom," wrote Gooch, "since it is now known how to cure Negroes without mercury." In 1751, a South Carolina slave doctor named Caesar developed several medical innovations, including an almost foolproof snake bite antidote. The cure featured a shrub called plantain and whorehound, a plant that derived its name from Egyptian priests who called it the seed of Horus, the Egyptian god of the sun and virtue, mixed with sassafras, wood ashes, and tobacco. On February 25 of that year, the South Carolina Gazette published the recipe as a public service, and demand ran so high that it was reprinted widely and published as a monograph in 1789. In 1799, it was mentioned in the text Domestic Medicine. Caesar's medical acumen earned him his freedom from the South Carolina General Assembly, which also granted him an annual pension of £100. Primus was another slave who won fame for medical achievements, which included a rabies treatment. The medical career of Wilsey Elf of Charleston, South Carolina, benefited rather than suffered when the white pharmacist to whom he was apprenticed turned out to be incapacitated by alcoholism. Left to his own devices, Elf formulated new medications, which proved so effective that his patent drugs became popular across the state. Meanwhile, Western doctors complained that overseers resorted to a standard remedy for every complaint, an emetic followed by calomel and oil. This chapter has sketched the roots of the friction between medical practitioners and African Americans. The next describes how medical experimentation heightened the aversion of black patients for white physicians. Chapter 2. Profitable Wonders. Antebellum medical experimentation with slaves and freedmen. Montgomery, Alabama, has not forgotten the heroic role of the three slaves, Anarka, Lucy, and Betsy, who suffered not only that they themselves might be cured, but that women injured in childbirth in future generations might be saved from lives of misery and invalidism. Seal Harris, Women's Surgeon, 1950. A lie told often enough becomes the truth. Lenin. When he escaped to England in 1847, the former slave who had been known as Fed claimed John Brown as his full name. Brown was a compact, dark-skinned man in his 40s, with strong features and a dense thatch of black hair that sprang from his crown at an angle, though it had been brushed to either side of an indeterminate part. His body bore the stigmata of enslavement. His hands were latticed with ropey scars, and the black iris of his bulging right eye lay off center, perpetually looking inward. For all this, the worn collodion image gracing his memoirs shows a man of estimable appearance in a sober woolen suit and brocade waistcoat. He is neither smiling nor frowning, but exudes a satisfied air of quiet dignity. a survivor. But of what? In 1855, Brown described his enslavement to L.A. Samarovzow, secretary of the British and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society, which published his memoirs as Slave Life in Georgia. Among Brown's most remarkable recollections was the period he spent with Dr. Thomas Hamilton of Clinton, Georgia, during the 1820s and early 1830s. Hamilton was not only a widely respected physician, but the very epitome of a Southern gentleman. He was born into wealth in Washington, Georgia, graduated from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and became a wealthy plantation owner, physician, politician, and trustee of the Medical Academy of Georgia. But Hamilton had another face. Brown recalls how he fell into the doctor's hands when his master, a man named Stevens, fell ill. "I do not know what his malady was. It must have been serious, for they called in to treat him one Dr. Hamilton, who lived in Jones County, who had a great name. He cured Stevens, who was so pleased that he told the doctor to ask him any favor, and it should be granted. Now it so happened that this Dr. Hamilton had been trying a great number of experiments for the purpose of finding out the best remedies for sunstroke. I was, it seems, a strong and likely subject to be experimented upon, and the doctor, having fixed the thing in his mind, asked Stevens to lend me to him. This he did at once, never caring to inquire what was going to be done with me. I myself did not know. Even if I had been made aware of the nature of the trials I was about to undergo, I could not have helped myself. There was nothing for it but passive resignation, and I gave myself up in ignorance and in much fear." Hamilton had a deep pit dug and built a fire in it that he damped so that only the burning embers remained. These were retained until the doctor, using a thermometer, ascertained that the pit was sufficiently hot. He then made Brown sit naked on a stool in the pit and covered the opening with a wet blanket to retain the heat. Only Brown's head was exposed while temperatures routinely exceeded 100 degrees. Hamilton then administered his various heat remedies until, Brown recalls, "though I tried hard to keep up against its effects, in about half an hour I fainted. I was then lifted out and revived, the doctor taking note of the degrees of heat when I left the pit." After each day's work in the fields, Brown was given some nostrum and made to repeat the ordeal. But after all this scientific effort, Hamilton resorted to chicanery. He, Hamilton, found that cayenne pepper tea accomplished his object, and a very nice thing he made of it. As soon as he got back home, he advertised that he had discovered a remedy for sunstroke. It consisted of pills which were to be dissolved in cayenne pepper tea, without which, he said, the pills would not produce any effect. "Nor do I see how they should have done so, for they were only made of common flour." However, he succeeded in getting them into general use, and as he asked a good price, he soon realized a large fortune. After a few days' rest, Brown was subjected to a new set of experiments, for which he was bled every other day. But still worse was to come. He set to work to ascertain how deep my black skin went. This he did by applying blisters to my hands, legs, and feet, which bear the scars to this day. He used to blister me at intervals of about 2 weeks. He also tried other experiments upon me, which I cannot dwell upon. After Brown's matter-of-fact account of being poached to the point of fainting and of his repeatedly burned and flayed skin, one wonders what other experimental horrors he cannot dwell upon. When he could bear the surgical torture no longer, Brown fled to England. There were many people like Brown. The preceding chapter sketched how scientific racism, abusive medical attentions, and iatrophobia, the fear and loathing many black Americans harbor toward the American medical establishment, are connected. However, African Americans have also been exploited as the subjects of abusive medical experimentation, which was once standard medical practice. More than scientific racism, more than heroic purges, bleedings, and cathartics, and more than the punitive use of therapeutics, involuntary medical experimentation was the scientific personification of enslavement. Violence, pain, and shame joined as physicians forced the enslaved body into medical service, not to cure, but for profit. Medical experimentation was profitable in terms of recovered health and life for whites, who benefited once the medical process had been perfected. It was also a profitable source of fame, and sometimes fortune, for physicians. Owners boarded the captive bodies of sick slaves to hospitals or hired well ones to physicians for use in experiments. Sometimes they sold a slave outright for such use, particularly if she had become too old or infirm to work or to breed. Many slave owners, such as Dr. Hamilton, Dr. Marion Sims, Dr. Nathaniel Bozeman, and Dr. Stillwell, were themselves physicians who bought and raised slaves for the express purpose of using them for experimentation. Not only slaves were thus used, but also free persons of color. The Perilous Trial. What constitutes medical experimentation? The word experiment comes from the Latin proposition ex, meaning from or out of, and periculum, a dangerous trial. To conduct an experiment is to risk success or failure, and when human health and lives hang in the balance, the stakes are high indeed. However, famed French researcher Claude Bernard provided the definitive feature of scientific experimentation in 1865. An experiment is an observation induced with the object of control. Thus, the researcher conducting an experiment does not simply observe a medical phenomenon. He or she induces a change under strictly controlled conditions, makes observations, and then logically analyzes them. Some medical experiments test treatments that may help the experimental subject. These are therapeutic experiments. Other experiments involve non-therapeutic tests that are not designed to help the experimental subject. The experimental standards that govern research today differ considerably from those physicians followed prior to the 20th century. Today, a matrix of legislation protects human subjects, at least in theory, and informed consent is a necessary requirement for most experiments with human beings. Informed consent is not a signed piece of paper, but rather the fluid, continuous process by which a researcher informs the subject in detail of what he or she proposes to do, why it is being proposed, and what possible consequences the experiment carries. Only then does the researcher ask the subject's permission, which must be obtained in writing. Despite the signing of the consent form, the process has not ended. The researcher must continue to inform the subject of developments in the experiment that could affect him, and the subject may withdraw from the experiment at any time. To perform an experiment without informed consent is a serious medical and legal abuse today. However, informed consent was not part of the ethical mores of the 18th and 19th centuries, and was not required by law. Physicians did typically ask a patient's consent to conduct experiments, but they did not explain their reasoning or detail their intent. In addition, when we consider 18th and 19th century experimentation, it is important to keep in mind that medicine of the period countenanced a larger degree of therapeutic modification than is allowed today. By the standards of past centuries, not every spontaneous decision to try a new, untested medication or combination can be considered unethical medical experimentation. For this reason, discussions of early medical experiments with African Americans in this chapter do not focus on lesser but still egregious ethical breaches, such as dangerous therapeutic experiments without informed consent. Neither do I discuss those many experimental approaches that were essentially therapeutic adjustments of commonly accepted remedies and methods. Southern physicians and scientists engaged in many such hazardous experiments, such as those of T.S. Hopkins, M.D., of Waynesville, Georgia, who prescribed caustic solutions of nitric acid to 5 black children for asthma. Similarly, Joseph E. May, M.D., prescribed Herculean doses of calomel and quinine to a slave with malaria, who, fortunately, recovered. These were hazardous experiments that would not have been practiced on whites, and they were done without the subject's permission. But their end was at least partially therapeutic. The doctor was trying to effect a cure. Instead, this chapter offers a few examples of the many experiments like those to which Brown was subjected. That is, they were involuntary, painful, dangerous, and either frankly non-therapeutic or obviously more harmful than beneficial. The experimental abuse of African Americans was not a cultural anomaly. It simply mirrored in the medical arena the economic, social, and health abuses that the larger society perpetuated against people of color, especially in the slaveholding states. No one, white or black, would have chosen to be the subject of a dangerous experiment. But blacks were especially wary, based upon their earlier abusive experiences with Western medicine. They were also wary because Western medical experimentation, with its mechanistic approach to the body, was philosophically inimical to the spiritual, community-based, and holistic African systems of healing as practiced by black healers. Western physicians had placed African holistic plant and spirit-centered healing systems outside the purview of medicine, relegating them to the realm of superstition, the occult, voodoo, and old wives' tales. In the same manner, many African Americans placed the experimentation to which they were subjected outside of the accepted modes of medicine and healing. Oral histories and extant writings suggest that many African Americans accepted and even incorporated some Native American and Western healing techniques, but considered invasive medical experimentation a form of medical torture or even of medical cannibalism. Before the early 20th century rise of the U.S. hospital movement, physicians and scientists conducted medical research in slave quarters, backyard shacks they designated as slave hospitals, and clinic wards. No organized body has coordinated coherent research plans, and some research was utterly spontaneous and unrecorded. Physicians' recollections, medical journals, and institutional records limb a pattern of abusing African Americans that was supported by custom and sometimes by law. These accounts could be astonishingly frank, because the authors were writing only for the eyes of other physicians, white males of their own class, who attended hospital wards and read medical journals. Moreover, African Americans were without legal protection, and thus unable to hamper physicians' activities. As a result, early medical records routinely identified African Americans as experimental subjects, especially in the slaveholding states. Half the original articles in the 1836 Southern Medical and Surgical Journal dealt with experiments performed upon blacks. It is true that blacks constituted a significant part of the South's population, nearly 40% in 1860. But they were still represented far above their proportions in hospitals and clinics. For example, when Dr. James Dugas pioneered a new eye surgery, 4 of his 5 experimental subjects, 80%, were black. Slaves were used preferentially to test genitourinary surgeries. Beginning in 1830, 30 of 37 experimental cesarean sections performed by Dr. François-Marie Prévost used slaves. Experimental ovariotomy and surgery for bladder stones also relied heavily upon black and mulatto subjects. In an exhaustive 1982 article detailing the antebellum experimental use of blacks, medical historian Todd Savitt summarized the risk. some whites took advantage of Southern blacks by testing new techniques or remedies in the name of medical progress. In several instances, physicians purchased blacks for the sole purpose of experimentation. In others, the doctors used free blacks and slaves owned by others. Not all experimental subjects were black, of course, and in northern states, where approximately 10% of blacks lived, white subjects tended to outnumber black subjects, although blacks were still used out of all proportion to their numbers. White subjects typically emanated from the lower social tiers. For example, Alex St. Martin, a poor French-Canadian trapper, was harassed, pursued, and studied for years by a successful physician who wished to experiment on him after an unusual accident caused a permanent opening in his stomach. So was Phineas Gage, a laborer who survived an industrial accident but suffered severe brain damage, which was assiduously recorded and tested by a long series of physicians. White subjects, however, enjoyed some legal protection and could leave when they wished, to the frustration of medical researchers. We have seen that scientific racists successfully promoted several necessary medical fictions that made blacks attractive as experimental subjects. Most physicians of the day also believed that blacks had low intellectual capacities and were sexually promiscuous, that diseases manifested differently in blacks, and that blacks could not be trusted to take medicine, follow treatment, or maintain basic standards of hygiene without white supervision. Finally, physicians believed that blacks naturally harbored diseases, notably syphilis, that threatened the health of whites. Each of these common beliefs served as rationales for abusive medical experimentation. One of the most tenacious beliefs was that blacks did not feel pain or anxiety, which excused painful surgical explorations without anesthesia on blacks. Dr. Charles White declared that blacks bear surgical operations much better than white people, and what would be the cause of insupportable pain for white men, a Negro would almost disregard. I have amputated the legs of many Negroes who have held the upper part of the limb themselves. And when Kentucky surgeon Ephraim McDowell wrote of gynecologic advances that were achieved by exquisitely painful surgeries, Dr. James Johnson, editor of the London Medical and Chirurgical Review, sneered. When we come to reflect that all the women operated upon in Kentucky, except one, were Negresses, and that these people will bear anything with nearly, if not quite, as much impunity as dogs and rabbits, our wonder is lessened.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. That is the end of the first audio segment. We'll pick up there for the second audio segment. The subsection will be Politics in the Laboratory. That's where we'll pick up at. Folks would like to chime in, observations, thoughts, questions, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to chime in and you do not have phone access, you can use the free VOPE line. Works anywhere in the world. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you do not want to, or if you need the address rather, the link is tinyty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace. When you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which, again, is 641-715-3640. The next line will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in your real name, a nickname. You can click random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. When you do so, I'll see your hand on the switchboard. They will ask you for an audio prompt. It'll say, press the number 1, press 1. I'll see your hand on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up should be with us. Feel free to chime in if you have questions on the first portion of the text.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, we can hear you. Greetings to the hosts and the rest of the callers and the listeners on the line. Just a couple of quick observations that stood out with so much. The first one, where they was talking about the older slaves being sold and where they would use something to blacken the beards. That stood out. And when I was talking about the rape, when the women said that, I think it was a particular slave that was being quoted and said that it was less humiliating to give in to the rape than to be forced. And the last observation that I had was where he talked about the, I think it was the, was it the planters? Or the physicians, where they gave or withheld consent for certain procedures. And that was so long ago, I actually experienced something like that under the quote-unquote Obamacare. I actually need an MRI. I'm suffering through an injury, and I'm being told that, oh, you just need an x-ray and we'll give you some physical therapy and you should be fine. I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. It's Demery Four here. Subversive doctoring. You know, in treating the black people, there were standard medical facts that they agreed upon at the time, but there was a process that by which the values and the principles of the system that was in place, which was the system of white supremacy, which encouraged insidious, dishonest, violent methods of treating black people and for monetary gain. Some of these research tests resulted in overdosing with toxic chemicals, withholding anesthesia, and pain medication. What doctors commonly agreed upon or that was accepted at the time was not even used to treat blacks, like the care, like the use of bloodletting, induced vomiting, diarrhea. We know now that they weren't valid medical treatments at all. Scientific fraud was used, the misuse of data that was collected by the researchers. This data was not used to increase the life expectancy of blacks or for them to recover or to live longer from deadly disease. Just the opposite. This data was used for monetary gain, like it is mostly today with the pharmaceutical companies, which pay for a lot of research, and even government entities that profit from these research tests. Testifying to the soundness in court became important and very lucrative for these white physicians. And it seemed like a setup to where they would say that the slave was sound. There's a difference in being sound and fit to being healthy, but they would say that the slaves were sound, and then once they were sickening later on, and the owners would try to recover, you know, some of their funds for what they paid for the slaves, then the physicians would make even more money testifying about the soundness of the slaves. And I wrote down that the mistreatment and the abuse of black people, she used the term actrophobia, black's fear of medicine. I think that should be replaced by the term white phobia, the fear of white people. It was the white physicians that had the blacks skeptical, and rightly so. I can remember in my hometown, you know, the closest black doctor was 30, 40 miles away, but black people would drive the distance because of the trust factor. And then there is the relationship that's supposed to be established between the patient and the doctor. That was non-existent. The physicians and the slave owners were had the relationship, and things were going the way that he wanted them to go, with no concern for the health of the black slaves. Paranoia is often associated with blacks and medicines, but I say that a healthy sense of skepticism when dealing with whites in any situation, especially medicine, would be best. And that noting that after years of the myths, malpractice, and killing of black people, the text only mentioned one white physician that did anything that was remotely to the advantage of black patients. Now, at the bottom of page 41, I've got scientists also claim that the primitive nervous systems of blacks were immune to physical and emotional pain and to mental illness. This belief, which will be discussed in greater length in the next chapter, released physicians and owners from the responsibility of shielding black slaves from painful medical procedures and justified torture such as branding, whipping, hobbling, and maiming. And I'd say that that belief is not logical, because the whipping, hobbling, and maiming were used as forms of punishment or mind control on the slaves. And if the slave owners and even the physicians did not believe that slaves could feel pain, then what need would it be to whip them or to, you know, cut off a foot or something after they ran away? And the selling of family members would prove that there was emotional pain involved in the slaves. I don't buy that portion. And the part about Frederick Gardner, the Mormon physician who thought that black slaves were treated less cruelly than the laboring class of the European countries, either he was lying to himself and others, or he didn't realize the difference between soundness and fitness and health. The doctor examining the slaves, the physician could care less about the slaves that he was examining. It was all for a monetary gain. And with that note, some of the herbs that they used, the implicate or whatever, that would produce violent vomiting. You know, most of the remedies or the medicine that they gave them would worsen the condition a lot of times, and if not, create excruciating pain and often death. Slaves who were, on page 46, it said slaves who were strong, young, and valuable received a quality of care that was denied to the feeble as well as the aged, who were often cast off the plantation or sold to physicians when the expense of their care exceeded their market value. Now, the book did mention, too, that some of the physicians would use black people as apprentices. You know, if you look into that closely, if they were buying slaves to use as test subjects in their research and practice, then if they had an apprentice, black slave, if he didn't have a research patient at that time, you know, then the apprentice probably would double as a helper or apprentice and also as a research patient. So we can't give any breaks to these whites. I think that they knew exactly what they were doing. It's no coincidence, because not only was it going on here in the United States, it was happening globally with other countries doing the same thing to black and brown and non-white subjects. And that's just a characteristic of the system of white supremacy. I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Mr. Demery and all the callers and the listeners. This book is just a treasure trove of incredible information. I'm going to touch on a few things. On page 38, she writes, according to ethnologists of the American school, black features marked them as a different species. Large buttocks and genitals that indicated hypersexuality, a head covering that was not hair but analogous to the wool of livestock, the size of the skull determined by painstaking but rigid measurements, the pronastous facial angles of blacks and thick lips that testified to their ape-like nature. Had scientists of the era more correctly noted that apes and chimpanzees have the thinnest of lips, they doubtless would have ignored this feature before they credited blacks with such an evolutionary advance. And it was just interesting to me that, you know, we've been equated with apes from the time we encountered white people. And I've studied animals since I was a very, very young child. I'm 42 now. And all the time that I've seen apes, whether they're silverback gorillas or chimpanzees, they have white skin. If you shave the hair off of a chimpanzee, their flesh is white. If you shave the hair off of a silverback gorilla, their flesh is white, minus their exposed parts, like their face and their hands. And I remember not too long ago, I did just some research on hair. And I just actually put in Google, what is the difference between fur and human hair? And essentially, another form of rhetorical ethics, there is no difference. White people made up this term to differentiate themselves from animals in the form of the hair that they have. So actually, the only people who don't have straight hair are people of African descent. So we stand out from the other variations of humanity that do have straight hair. So I just found this just very telling. And then the discussion on syphilis and just studying the development of the disease in black people, syphilis and gonorrhea were actually interspecies diseases that actually were brought to Africans from white people having sex with livestock. So, I mean, every encounter we have with them turns out to be deadly for our people, and their ability to dehumanize us actually brings their lack of humanity into center focus when we pay attention. On page 42, Dr. Washington writes, all of these precepts of scientific racism, although convenient for the slave owner and physician, were highly illogical articles of faith. So was the supposed inferior intelligence of blacks, because planters and doctors behaved in many contexts as though they held the abilities and judgment of blacks in high regard, employing slaves in responsible positions as nurses, cooks, herbalists, midwives, overseers, leaders of work gangs, accountants, and operators of farm and factory implements. Owners reap profits from the many patents on slave inventions, and physicians use slaves as skilled apprentices, who often went on to practice independently. White households depended upon the specialized skills and discernment of slaves, not the other way around. And this kind of speaks to something that I've learned throughout my study of racism, white supremacy, and how it relates to black people who were kidnapped and forcibly enslaved. They took the best of what Africa had to offer and brought them to the Western Hemisphere. That is how America became the so-called the best and most powerful country on earth, was through the kidnap of black people and the fact that we understood how to nation build and we had all of the elements of a functional society long before we met white people. And it's just interesting because it reminds me of my grandmother in Trinidad. She had remedies for everything. If you came to her with just about any illness, she would just tell you specific herbs to go out and pick, and she would boil you a tea or make you a poultice or something of that nature, and it would fix whatever the problem was. There was not a person who, both of my grandmothers for that matter, who did, they had such incredible knowledge, and sadly they didn't pass it on to any of the younger people. This was weird how these things, these sciences die when elders do not communicate with the youth. And it, again, speaks to a lot of what you talk about when you and other callers have talked about speaking to our elders and really having discussions, because I was very young watching my grandmother, both my grandmothers do these types of things. And those are things I was not able to garner from them before they passed. Neither was my mother or my father. So it's just interesting because they understood that Africans had a wealth of knowledge that they could exploit to their benefit, and they actually did so. But in their scientific, racist, white supremacist approach to life, they could not see fit to treat us as the human beings that we were and allow us to flourish and, you know, do what we could have done, which was excel to the best of our ability. The section that Mr. Demery was talking about, it's on page 46. He had read a section there, but there's a section above that where they talk about once pregnant women typically were kept at hard labor until their fifth month, and recalcitrant pregnant women were made to lie in the trenches that accommodated their bellies so they could be beaten without harming the unborn child. I mean, how sick can you get? Like, literally, you're going to dig a hole to put a pregnant woman's stomach in so you can expose her back and just light her up with a cat of nine tails? Like, that is just the sickest, most debased behavior I could think of. And then beyond that, in the same paragraph where they just talk about the use and discarding of black people, just lab rats and less than animals. Like, our treatment is just ridiculous. And then, Mr. Demery also put up the section on page 48 where they talk about giving slaves, Dr. Kilpatrick gives sick niggers Ipecac and Asafoetida and oil and turpentine and black fever pills. Asafoetida is an actual herb that I burn in my house to cleanse my house. It's one of the most potent herbs to get rid of negative spiritual energy, but it stinks. It smells so bad, it's like almost nauseating to think of. So I can't imagine what it was for them to actually eat this or partake of it. And black fever pills, I don't know what that is. And Ipecac, like Mr. Demery said, makes you violently throw up. So a lot of their, what they call medicine, was actually quite debased and just chemically based. Nothing about them is natural. And on the same page, bottom of the page, it says, appeals to God and the importance of moral fitness and the enlisting the help of departed spirits, especially the intercession of ancestors, all key to the African-based healing process. Ancestors who were angered by disrespect or neglect could cause illness, alienation, and other troubles for the living. This was one reason that the respectful ritual treatment of the dead was so important to slaves, and why they reviled Western medicine when they discovered that physicians appropriated the bodies of dead slaves for display and dissection. Western medicine was thought ineffective against spirit-caused illnesses, and slaves lacked confidence in a Western doctor's ability to cure them. This just reminds me of studying Nile Valley history and high culture, and the fact that in Africa, we have been performing brain surgery, heart surgery, thousands of years before Christ walked. Imhotep is referenced in the Hippocratic Oath as Asclepius, which is the Greek god of medicine. So our the knowledge of our abilities in medicine was world-renowned from many, many millennia before we encountered white people. And in Egypt, when they would give you a prescription, they had deities for each hour of the day. So you had to take that prescription at a specific hour, say a specific prayer to a specific deity of that hour, as well as to your ancestors for your healing. It was such a holistic form of healing that we don't experience today unless you have connections with those traditional African healers who still practice those techniques, because they're still there on the continent, and there's people, some people who have come to the Western Hemisphere and do the same. So ultimately, we don't even understand what we're missing when we go to these doctors that have on these white lab coats in these so-called sterile environments, which have some of the deadliest diseases ever, to get treated. And also just the history of the hospital. In Europe, you sent your relatives to the hospital to die. So what a hospice is today is what the hospital was in Europe. In Nile Valley, Africa, we had something called the Per-Ankh, which means house of life. And that was where they performed surgeries and did the most extensive holistic healing in history before Christ. So, I mean, just a difference in concept as far as what a hospital was actually used for originally versus what our ancestors had in Africa is mind-blowing. So, I mean, this book is just bringing out just incredible amounts of information. The use of black medicine, it says in 1729, on page 50, Lieutenant Governor Gooch of Virginia authorized the payment of £60 to manumit an unnamed Negro man. Gooch declared that his mixture of pharmacologically active roots and bark had proved an effective syphilis remedy. It is well worth the price of the Negro's freedom, wrote Gooch, since it is now known how to cure Negroes without mercury. So, I mean, just look at that. This black male was able to create an all-natural cure from herbs, and he just said it. They thought that mercury, one of the most poisonous substances on earth, could cure syphilis. I mean, white people are just savage. There's no scientific method to anything that they do, and anything that they do with black people is going to be detrimental to the life and survival of black people. Thank you so much for taking my call, Gus, and I'll mute my line there.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. Great book. I can see the layers are unpeeling. The Missive Knee Benders. Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. I kind of, I guess, came to the same thought concept as Vosh, whereas, with the fur in here. You know, this is sort of like, you know, to me, the Planet of the Apes. Because, you know, it's like the wrong people are in charge. You know what I'm saying? Now, people have hair, animals have fur. And I always go to the first dictionary when I look up words first. And this is from the 1828 Noah Webster Dictionary. Fur is a short, fine, soft hair of certain animals growing thick on the skin, and distinguished from hair, which is longer and coarser. Fur is one of the perfect conductors of heat, and it serves to keep animals warm in calm and cold climates. Now, white people don't have coarse stuff on them. They have fur. They don't have hair. You know, they're not, you know what I'm saying? And like you just said, if you skim a monkey, you got a white person. So I think that they kind of switching things around. And the submissive knee benders, who could seemingly withstand all these diseases and parasites and could work for long hours in the sun and have elongated penises and bigger butts and better breast positioning and, you know. But see, my thing with this is white people do everything in the context of white supremacy. And when you read, when you're listening to some of the things that the white people were reading that I guess you quoted, you know, white people aren't ignorant. White people knew good and well that black people had superior genetics to them. You know, they knew that, or they wanted to set up a system of racism, white supremacy. So they are writing all these books and coming up with all these concepts, knowing, because, I mean, these are doctors. They know better. I mean, knowing that, you know, we're lying. You know, we're going to switch everything around because it's no way, you know. You know, and honestly, also, what great medicine were they making back then? I mean, when we all know from reading the Henrietta Lacks book that they didn't have perfect medicine and pharmaceutical procedures until they got the HeLa cells, and that was some time from, you know, this. So this is all, you know, some you know, witchcraft, some white witchcraft is what they're really doing to these people, which is terrible. And that part where he said, you know, they could withstand pain, you know, I mean, you could cut off, I had decapitated one of their legs, and he held the top part while I cut the bottom part off. You know, I mean, he probably would have got whipped if he didn't. You know, this is just, you know, I could just see this is going to be one of those books. But I'll mute my line. Thank you for taking my call.
Mandy Hurst?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Mr. Indicate. Good evening, of course.
Your line is really choppy. I'm not sure what it is. It's let's try again, Carmen, see if it's a little clearer.
That was me. This should be better.
Much better.
Is that better? Okay, I'm sorry about that. I've always said that hair is curly and fur is straight. And, you know, if you're just going to do a general comparison, animals usually have most of that fur on their back, you know, and European people have all of those problems with all of that fur on their back. You know, it's not something that we typically have to get waxed on our back. So it's just a correlation that I noticed. And just to help us out here, since we do have a lot of problems trying to get health insurance, get health care. The caller had said that he was having a problem getting an MRI. But I don't know if this will work or not, but in Western medicine, the one thing they are cognizant of is that anything that will cause you to lose consciousness is the same thing that will cause you to lose your life. Anything that can steal your consciousness, because you hold on to that, your brain holds on to that, will cause you to lose your life. So if you ever want to get a completely unconcerned doctor's attention, just say, yeah, you know, I passed out. And I'm feeling pretty good. Don't know why I passed out. The only thing really hurting is my knee. So you can get a lot of medical attention and a lot of tests if you just say that you lost consciousness. I wouldn't go with more than two. That'll help. And the other thing is he said that the Dr. Yustu experimented on them to see how deep the black went, so they would give them blisters. If you ever get a real burn, like you touch an oven rack or you touch anything hot, if you can immediately get to cold running water, like within, you know, 5 seconds or so, and if you can bear to run the cold running water on that, even if you're in the shower and in all your clothes, for 5 minutes, because that's miserable. Cold running water for 5 minutes is miserable. You can keep yourself from getting a blister or even a third degree burn, actually. But it is pretty miserable, and if it's your child, you're going to have to fight them to keep that hand or foot or whatever under cold running water for 5 minutes, but it's really worth it. It really works. And she was also talking about, she says there was some white people in the North we experimented on. She mentioned a white guy who had a hole in his stomach, and then she said another white guy, but she didn't say what he had. So I wonder if the editor was practicing, you know, racism, white supremacy by omitting the malady that this other white guy had. And I recognize the name. I'm sure he's the white man who had the, maybe, maybe not, but the short-term memory problem where that movie 50 First Dates came from. You can't remember anything past a day. And I think that white people don't tell us all of these weird neurological things they have because they have so many. They just deteriorate neurologically, like they have some a neurological time bomb inside of them, you know, Huntington's chorea and multiple sclerosis. They are plagued by these neurological just deficits that just rack them. And I think that maybe the editor or someone left that out so that it wouldn't bring attention to the fact that white people just deteriorate like gangbusters when it comes to neurological diseases. And last but not least, giving anesthesia to white people, especially some white people, is like a nightmare. You cannot sleep these people. And so I wonder if maybe that's where the fake thing came from. You give a black person an ampule of a narcotic and, you know, and you give a white person an ampule of a narcotic, and the white person's still screaming. You cannot sleep these people. They don't process pain medication. I don't know if that's because they're always on something and they're always sneaking something and taking something, and so they just don't process pain medication right. But I tell you, they just don't. They really don't. They take drugs that would just kill an elephant. But it just doesn't seem to have any effect on them when it comes to narcotics and pain relief. So, never really understood why. Okay, those were my observations.
Special. We had, I believe, one of our narrators from Foot in Each World. Did you have commentary you wanted to share? Caller at 8791. Did you have commentary you wanted to share? 8791. Okay. Maybe.
Hello, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
I apologize. This is V. Thank you for allowing me to get on the line. I did have a couple quick comments. One was in reference to, it was touched on earlier by Roz, how they would treat the slaves back in the slave times with turpentine. And I remember my mom telling me about this when I was younger, and I just got in my head, you know, she didn't know what she was talking about. She's calling it turpentine, but it had to be something else. Couldn't have been turpentine. And my mom was, you know, just born in 31. So the fact that as recent as that time, they were still treating blacks with turpentine in this country. So that I found was very fascinating. The other comment I wanted to make was in reference to the midwives. I am also in the birth work world and as a doula. And even today, well, the comment that was made in the book on 49 was in reference to how some whites were impressed with Negro doctors and doctresses, as they were called, but some were very skeptical and critical of their skills, even to the point of saying that, oh, well, because it holds no scientific, I just want to make sure I quote correctly. They call them unscientific midwives, alluding to the fact of, you don't really have to have a lot of knowledge in order to birth a baby. So they were, trying to allude to the fact, that's why they have so much success, because they don't need a lot of knowledge. And we actually face the same criticisms and, feelings today about being a black midwife, doula, someone in the birth world who isn't going through the traditional nurse midwife college courses in order to help our communities. There's a lot of political pushback, even in the medical field, pushback to prevent professional midwives and doulas from working and assisting our communities and lowering the, maternal mortality rate and as well as infant mortality rate. But it's a proven fact. It's been scientifically proven that using those traditional techniques dating back to African the African times, back when, the women's job to help their daughters, their granddaughters, their nieces, anyone in the area to, birth their children. And using these techniques today have been proven to lower the mortality rate, to lower the cesarean rate, where back then they would use, the slaves to perform cesareans. And from what I'm reading, without anesthesia, without pain medicine, and if anyone has had, any female has had any type of abdominal surgery, that is very painful. It's a painful recovery. You feel like your insides are just going to come out. So just to have to go through that with no anesthesia, no pain, medicine, it's unfathomable. I couldn't even think of what they went through. So I just wanted to comment on those two things. I'm glad I was able to get on without any background noise. So thanks again, and greetings to everyone.
For sure, for sure. Good to hear from you. The person that called in from a block number, did you have commentary you wanted to add?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in about, I remember when I was a kid, a lot of older black people would tell other black people, if you have cancer, don't go to the hospital and get surgery, because when they open you up, it spreads. And when I got older, I just thought that was just foolish talking. I don't know anything about that. But even today, some older black people say that. And when I first moved away from home, I was really heavily into exercising and jogging and lifting weights and just really into physical activity. As a result of that, I've had to get a total knee when I got older and a total ankle. And I talked to my sister, who still lives at home, she really would get on me. She said, "Don't be letting them doctors cut you open and stuff, because that's all them white folks want to do. They just want to cut you open and all that." And she won't go for mammograms or anything, and she thinks I'm crazy for getting mammograms every year and for getting physicals every year, because she's saying that the doctors, they will put, they're using me for experiments, and they're, doing all kind of, terrible things to me. And I'm telling her that's not true. Mammograms could save your life, because our mother died of breast cancer, my mother's sister died of breast cancer, and my mother's niece died of breast cancer. I said, so it's in our family on our mother's side really bad, but she doesn't believe it, and she's always scolding me whenever I go to the doctor about anything. And I used to, you know, to myself, I would laugh at her at first, but now, you know, after reading this book, because I read most of this book about a couple years ago, but now after reading this book and reading the story of Henrietta Lacks, I understand where a lot of that kind of thinking comes from. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
For sure. I'll just add a few quick comments and then we'll get to the second audio segment. That portion, I think a few of y'all have touched on, that said that, you know, black people have a distinctive knee joint and this long heel that proves that they are submissive knee benders. I think we talked about yesterday the use of religion, because it says that God created them in this manner to substantiate white terrorism. When they noted the, I guess depends on how you look at it, that 20% of slaves were still Native Africans in 1780, and that this had dropped to only 10% by 1830. We talked about that before. That's kind of the main thesis of American Slave Coast. The Sublet's book that we talked about earlier this year, that is the product of rape. It doesn't get described that way in this book. And most of the time when people talk about this, she says it gets described in this book as the progeny of black-white matings. That should be rape. That's the way that we should be talking about this at all times, even if it is an enslaved black person and an enslaved black female and an enslaved black male reproducing, that is still forced rape under the system of white supremacy. Moving forward, I thought it was really significant when she noted that their conceptualization of fitness or health of enslaved black people was more driven by, is this nigger fit for me to sell, to make a profit, to work, to be raped, to reproduce children? Not necessarily, are they in great physical condition? Are they doing well? Have they been taken care of? Two totally different things. I suspect that is probably still in use in terms of how health of black people is conceptualized worldwide. I also thought it was significant that they conceptualized when whites got any diseases that were associated with black people, that they had done something incorrect, or they were punished for not owning slaves or not doing their part to uphold the system of white supremacy. Let's see. Got that. Yeah, I think she emphasizes it here when she talked about the portion where the enslaved black male was talking about different things that he could do to try to fool potential buyers so that he would not be purchased to be enslaved. And then Eliza, when she comes forward, beautiful black female, and she's purchased, when it says there were many eager bids for her, for such as she, the demands of slavery were insatiable. Again, the necessary rape. Again, that's the main thesis of the Sublet's book. The rape of black people, of black females, required, had to happen. I super love Harriet Washington. She says soundness for women and sometimes for men was tied to sexual attractiveness and reproductive ability, that she includes black males. I think that's something we've touched on for quite a few of our book study sessions this year, especially when we did The Half Has Never Been Told, that this sexual abuse, sexual tyranny was not just directed at females, black females, that black males were raped as well, that's something that just gets minimized and not discussed very often when we're talking about all of this. They include the same portion from Thomas Jefferson that was included in the Sublet's text, where he talks about the importance of having breeders, making breeders out of enslaved black females. And then blaming the black females for this rape, that they're just hot-blooded. You see that same sort of logic used today. A lot of that came out during the Daniel Holtzclaw trial. I have the electronic version, so the pages won't match up. But when she says, as the personal property of master, black women had no social or legal protection. They could not legally be raped. Even consensual relationships had to be viewed through the lens of enslavement. In her memoirs, former slave Harriet Jacobs sadly mused that she eventually acquiesced to sexual demands because it was less humiliating to give in than to be forced. That, for sure, is still on display today, 2016. Some of that was her in the Daniel Holtzclaw trial, Oklahoma. Also, it reminded me of The Half Has Never Been Told, that we read earlier this year, the portion when I asked callers what they thought, when he wrote, "Of course, some women of African-American descent use their sexuality to create a little leverage for themselves." And I said, I do not think that that is an accurate way of describing it. Could even be just a direct, blatant act of white supremacy to describe it in those terms. If you are being terrorized constantly, could be butchered, mutilated, whipped, for any perceived insolence, disobedience, and in fact, you don't even have to do anything, just trying the best you can to minimize the amount of mistreatment and abuse that you're going to experience. That, to me, is not leveraging your situation, but it reminded me of that portion of the text. I thought it was just fantastic information about the African healers, midwives, doulas. It reminded me of Shafia Monroe. She's the founder of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. She was on the program in 2012, Black Female. She talked about a lot of this information, and she included, it wasn't just, as Roz pointed out, which was great, but it wasn't just a failure of Black people, us not talking to our ancestors to get this information or not being passed on, that white people, as came out in this book, that there was a significant amount of racism to erode this, to keep this tradition from being passed on amongst the Black people, and to hoard Black people to going to the hospitals, to white doctors, white physicians, to be further abused and maligned, that this was done deliberately in this area of the world, and I suspect worldwide. And you even today, with the resurgence of midwives, doulas, and having more natural child birthing practices, you still see that. I've seen news reports where they are talking about if you don't have your child born in a hospital, that they could have some sort of punitive measures in place. There still seems to be a lot of practices put in place to keep these sort of more healthful medical practices, to keep particularly Black people from engaging in these behaviors. Let's see, anything else? Certainly this whole section where it talked about the disgust, where you had white people who were either stealing these medical practices, things that were brought from the continent that we had been doing for a long time, medical practices and what have you, to heal and take care of ourselves, stealing these practices and giving white people credit or just suppressing it completely. It reminded me of Matula Shakur, who did a lot of work in the liberation for Black people, particularly who was working to try to combat the chemical poisoning of Black people with all the drugs and what have you, and using acupuncture and other natural healing remedies to stop this and to cure the addictions that Black people were facing, ended up being put in jail. And he talks extensively about the attacks that Black people faced who were doing the same thing, healthful, curing remedies, who were under attack during the 60s and 70s by white people. He's still in greater confinement today. Just thought that was really important. I'm so glad that she included that in terms of the hostility that whites had for Black medical practitioners. And I think you see a lot of that today, where Black people who engaged in these behaviors then or now are thought of as some sort of witch doctors, crackpots. Oh my gosh, you're just, you know, doing these superstitious nonsense, mumbo jumbo from way back in. So they just continue to degrade anything in connection with Africa, anything in connection to Black people, and to always elevate racism, white supremacy. White people have to be experts at everything, including medicine. See, last thing I'll get in before we move forward. I also thought it was important, too, that this was not something that was just restricted to enslaved Black people, that this was something that they were utilizing, employing against, quote unquote, free Black people as well. I thought that was especially important also. I think I will stop there so we have ample time to share after the second audio segment. If there were things that you did not get an opportunity to discuss or thought were significant, just make a note. We should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. Again, we're picking up. The subsection is Politics in the Laboratory. That's where the second audio segment will pick up at. We will start there. Context of White Supremacy. Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid. Audio segment number two.
Politics in the Laboratory. Although experimentation with African Americans was the medical norm, especially in the South, some whites were deeply opposed to it. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, abolitionists wrote exposés, and in 1839, Theodore Wright Weld uncovered the cruelty of medical experimentation in American Slavery as It Is, declaring, "Public opinion would tolerate surgical experiments, operations, and processes performed upon slaves, which it would execrate if performed upon their masters." Such pointed criticism may help to explain why some physician scientists who spoke candidly of injecting, dosing, or performing revolutionary surgeries on their slave patients in the first half of the 19th century expressed their actions more guardedly in later writings. For example, Dr. James Marion Sims eventually hid his subject's race and even illustrated reports of experiments on black slave women with illustrations of bourgeois white matrons. Journals sometimes dispensed with racial labels, although their articles still offered broad social cues about their subjects' ethnicity. Language was often tortured to disguise the racial nature of hazardous experimentation. In the best patrician tradition of his times, Thomas Jefferson was not only a country squire and leading politician, but also a scientist. Eager to make his mark, Jefferson embarked on enthusiastic adventures in vaccination by gambling with the lives of his slaves. He wished to establish that Edward Jenner's new technique of vaccination was superior to the technique of inoculation, or as it came to be called a century later, variolation. Inoculation consisted of inserting or injecting infected material from a sick person directly into a well one to induce immunity. Vaccination, in this era, referred to the process of injecting cowpox to provide immunity to smallpox, as Jenner first described in 1796. Jefferson obtained some cowpox vaccine directly from Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse of Boston, but it was known to be of dubious potency. The vaccine had failed to protect the subjects of an earlier trial. Jefferson spent that summer vaccinating 200 of his family's and his neighbors' slaves. Only after they escaped illness did Jefferson inject his white family at Monticello. The vaccinated persons remained well, and the unvaccinated ones fell ill. But this did not convince Jefferson's scientific peers, so Jefferson had a vaccinated slave injected with live smallpox material. When this slave remained well, Jefferson wrote his daughter Martha to proceed in order to place our families and neighbors in perfect security. As a seasoned politician, Jefferson knew that his experiments on slaves would be criticized, and they seemed at variance with his sympathetic statements about blacks. So he slyly used language to deflect possible criticism, referring to conducting experiments on some of my own family, without clarifying that the family in question consisted of slaves owned by himself and his son. An epidemic of typhoid fever raged in Virginia throughout the summer of 1832, and planters feared that the infected slaves would be unable to work and would endanger whites. Dr. Robert G. Jennings had no cure, but he decided to test a hunch that smallpox vaccine might protect against typhoid. He administered the vaccine to 30 blacks, slave and free, choosing them from uninfected family members of typhoid patients, in order to guarantee they would be exposed. He then withheld the vaccine from other uninfected family members. Jennings reported that those who were vaccinated remained disease-free. The unvaccinated became ill. When Jennings then vaccinated blacks suffering from typhoid, he jubilantly recorded that they recovered more quickly. Jennings delivered the investigative coup de grace when he decided to vaccinate 11 of 12 family members, withholding vaccine from the 12th. Only the unvaccinated slave fell ill. This successful experiment on an enslaved population defies all logic, because smallpox vaccine is not efficacious against typhoid. One cannot be certain whether serendipity or outright fraud was involved, but the mathematical odds against such results arising by luck are staggering, and no one has ever successfully duplicated Jennings' experiment. Many other experiments on slaves accrued no benefit to the black subject, and white patients were not asked, and certainly were not forced, to assume these risks. The next decade saw an escalation of sadism in experiments on slaves. The 1846 records of Dr. Walter F. Jones of Petersburg, Virginia, reveal that he experimented by pouring boiling water on naked, enslaved typhoid pneumonia patients at four-hour intervals. He described one such treatment on a sick 25-year-old enslaved man. The patient was placed on the floor on his face, and about 5 gallons of water at a temperature so near the boiling point as to barely allow immersion of the hand was thrown immediately on the spinal column, which seemed to arouse his sensibilities somewhat, as shown by an effort to cry out. Jones didn't reveal what had inspired him to try this remedy, and he offered a rather thin rationale for the treatment, suggesting only that it worked by somehow reestablishing the capillary circulation. In June of the same year, John M. B. Hardin, M.D., of Liberty County, Georgia, published an article in the Southern Medical and Surgical Journal that described how he had stripped blood vessels from the limbs of a Negro and of 3 hogs. Hardin then measured the width of the blood vessels to determine the relative areas of the trunks and branches of arteries, with the stated intent of furthering anatomical knowledge. But none of these increasingly painful medical intrusions was as infamous as the slave experimentation conducted by James Marion Sims, M.D., of Alabama. James Marion Sims, Savior and Sadist. James Marion Sims is an important figure in the history of experimentation with African Americans because he so well embodies the dual face of American medicine to which racial health disparities owe so much. Sims is revered as a women's benefactor, although he conducted years of nightmarishly painful and degrading experiments without anesthesia or consent on a group of slave women. He was born into a struggling family of 10 in Hanging Rock, near Lancasterville, South Carolina, in 1813. In his autobiography, The Story of My Life, Sims described how, despite a career as an indifferent, mediocre student, he gained entrance first to South Carolina Medical College and then to Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. In the manner of the day, his medical education consisted of a year and a half of instruction. Sims confessed that he initially found his medical training wanting. "When it came time to making up a prescription, I had no more idea of what to do than if I had never studied medicine." But once he embarked upon practice on the plantations of Alabama, these feelings of inadequacy did not prevent him from blaming enslaved mothers for the high death rates of their infant children. He ascribed neonatal tetanus, newborn tetanus, or trismus nascentium, to the mother's moral and intellectual failures. "Whenever there are poverty and filth and laziness, or where the intellectual capacity is cramped, the moral and social feelings blunted, there it will be oftener found. Wealth, a cultivated intellect, a refined mind, an affectionate heart, are comparatively exempt from the ravages of this unmercifully fatal malady. But expose this class to the same physical causes, and they become equal sufferers with the first." Neonatal tetanus is caused by a bacterial infection with Clostridium tetani, which emanates from animal manure and thrives in wounds such as healing umbilical stumps. Thus, Sims perceived the connection between filth and illness, which was not yet an accepted medical belief, but he blamed the wrong parties. Owners built slave shacks on inferior lands near horse stables and other quarters, and as far as possible from the whites' dwellings. Antebellum doctors' disdain for hand washing, as well as the midwifery practice of swaddling the umbilical cord with rags, raised the risk of infection. But by attributing tetanus to laziness and weakness of slaves, he deflected attention from the simplest way of removing contagion, relocating and improving slave dwellings. Today, we know the deaths were probably the caregiver's fault. As a plantation doctor, Sims attended many children, but he used only the black infants as subjects for dangerous experiments in tetany, a long misunderstood children's neuromuscular disease characterized by convulsions and muscle spasms. The tetany that was epidemic among enslaved children was actually the result of severe calcium, magnesium, and vitamin D deficiency caused by chronic malnutrition. But Sims was erroneously convinced that it was caused by the displacement of skull bones during birth. He took a sick black baby from its mother, made incisions in its scalp, then wielded a cobbler's tool to pry the skull bones into new positions. During this time, I would occasionally puncture the scalp over the lambdoidal suture with the point of a crooked awl and prise out the edges of the parietal bones away, with the effect of greatly modifying the rigid floor of the extremities. Sims's attempt to open the skull was based upon a scientific myth that the bones of black infants' skulls, unlike white infants, grew together quickly, leaving the brain no space to grow and develop. This premature closing of the black skull was held to cause low intelligence and perpetual childishness in adult blacks. When the infants died, Sims castigated the sloth and ignorance of their mothers and the black midwives who attended them. Sims soon acquired 17 slaves, whom he used in his experiments and as workers in his clinic laboratory. The first three such patients fared miserably under Sims's faltering scalpel. One 19-year-old enslaved man died after two heroic operations, including the unanesthetized removal of bone segments, presumably to prevent the spread of an infection. Sims's account of the surgeries glossed over the patient's deaths to dwell upon technical details of greater interest to his medical readers. Mistakes, such as a patient's near suffocation from a sponge that Sims forgot to remove from his mouth after removing part of his cancerous jaw, and Sims's failure to stanch a patient's bleeding from the carotid artery, were also given short shrift. But these were a mere prelude. On a June day in 1845, 17-year-old Anarka, a slave on the Westcott Plantation just outside of Montgomery, Alabama, felt the contractions that heralded the birth of her first child. 3 days later, the exhausted, terrified girl still writhed in excruciating labor. Sims was called in and used obstetrical forceps, with which he admitted he had little experience. The child died, and although Anarka seemed out of immediate danger, she soon faced another horrible trial. Her torn vagina began eroding, and she was left with openings between the remains of her vagina and her bladder and rectum. She was now incontinent, and the incessantly flowing urine inflamed her ravaged tissues, triggering pain, recurrent infections, and odor. As terrible as Anarka's condition was, a certain hyperbole entered Sims's description of it. He compared it to smallpox and stressed its unpleasantness for spectators, as well as the fact that it made her unfit for work, a planter's perspective. Anarka was far from alone in her misery. Her condition, vesicovaginal fistula, afflicted many women, black and white, who survived difficult childbirth. However, enslaved women had an especially high rate of this complication. Despite physicians' tendency to blame the ignorance and obtrusive interference of our plantation accoucheurs and nigger midwives, Sims himself conceded that the rates of vesicovaginal fistula had risen when obstetricians began using forceps. The condition may well have been due to a confluence of malnutrition, forceps use, and Anarka's youth. The vitamin D deficiency that was very common among malnourished slave women caused bone defects, including a small pelvis. This made birth difficult, especially in the underdeveloped pelvises of very young women, and slave women became mothers approximately 3 years earlier than did white women. Vesicovaginal fistula is emotionally and socially devastating, and it condemned many a southern lady to permanent invalidism. Sims knew that curing it would make his medical fortune, and he also knew that using white women to test such painful surgeries as might be effective against it was impossible. Historian Walter Fisher sums it up. It is most improbable that Sims and his assistant, Bozeman, could have established so remarkable a surgical schedule without the slave system which provided the experimental subjects. Slaves did not have to be recruited, persuaded, and cajoled to endure pain and indignity. They could not refuse. Sims acquired a total of 11 women slaves with vesicovaginal fistula from their masters by promising to lodge, board, and treat them, and he built a Spartan wooden building where he conducted surgical experiments on them for the next 4 years. During the Victorian period, layers of dress signaled sexual chastity, and doctors were not in the habit of viewing women's unclothed bodies. Not even their professional stature gave them license to gaze at women's genitalia. When Sims undertook his fistula experiments, even the term gynecology was a few years in the future. Instead, women's doctors averted their eyes in a chivalrous fashion as they knelt to tend the modestly clothed ladies of their class, relying upon their sense of touch beneath voluminous Victorian skirts. However, Sims, working with enslaved blacks, was constrained by no such delicacy. He made the women undress completely, then kneel on hands and knees, while he and several physicians took turns inserting a special speculum he had devised to open the women's vaginas fully to view. "I saw everything as no man had seen before," marveled Sims. Montgomery physicians flocked to Sims's shack to see what no man had seen before. So did prominent citizens and local apprentices. The surgeries themselves were terribly painful. Not only had Sims to close the unnatural openings in the ravaged vaginal tissues, he had to make the edges of these openings knit together. He opted to abrade, or scarify, the edges of the vaginal tears every time he attempted to repair an opening. He then closed them with sutures and saw them become infected and reopen, painfully, every time. Several male doctors had initially assisted Sims by holding down the enslaved women as he made incisions. But within a year, they could bear neither the bone-chilling shrieks of the women nor the lack of progress any longer. The doctors left, leaving the women to take turns restraining one another. Later, Sims recruited Dr. Nathan Bozeman as a protege and assistant. Bozeman was a recent medical graduate of the University of Louisville and had trained with some of the best surgeons in the region, such as Professor Samuel D. Gross. Medical journals and professional word of mouth had detailed the inhalation of ether as anesthesia since the early 1840s, and Sims knew of this, but he flatly refused to administer anesthesia to the slave women and girls. He claimed that his procedures were not painful enough to justify the trouble and risk attending the administration. But this claim rings hollow when one learns that Sims always administered anesthesia when he performed the perfected surgery to repair the vaginas of white women in Montgomery a few years later. Sims also cited the popular belief that blacks did not feel pain in the same way as whites. However, Sims's own words belie him. In his memoirs, he noted that Lucy's agony was extreme. She was much prostrated, and I thought she was going to die. Sims further obscured the truth in 1852, when he described the first surgery on Lucy, writing, "That was before the days of anesthetics, and the poor girl, on her knees, bore the operation with great heroism and bravery." Sims's refusal to administer ether seems even less defensible in light of his willingness to administer it very freely to another group of women, without apparent regard for its trouble and risk. In New York during the 1860s, Sims attended white women patients who suffered from vaginismus, a disorder marked by painful vaginal muscle contractions that prevent the entrance of the penis, making intercourse impossible. Complaining husbands approached Sims, who regularly etherized their wives, rendering them unconscious so that their husbands could have sex with them. Sims's writings often utilized imprisonment as a metaphor for the control that he saw as key to restoring a woman's health. his enslaved experimental subjects were the ultimate incontrollable patients, and he eventually chose to control his slaves' pain in a peculiar manner. He addicted the slave women to morphine, but he gave it to them, some form of opium in as large doses as can be borne, at least twice in 24 hours, only after surgery, administering it for several weeks each time. Sims explained that opium calms the nerves, inspires hope, relieves the scalding of the urine, and permitted the patient doomed to a fortnight's horizontal position to pass the time with pleasant dreams and delightful sensations instead of painful forebodings and intolerable sufferings. The morphine did ease recovery, but it did not allay the pain of the procedure itself, so this practice perplexed some of Sims' contemporaries. The most logical explanation is that this practice had more to do with controlling the women's behavior than controlling their pain, because the addiction weakened their will to resist repeated procedures. As mentioned earlier, the medical association between assiduous cleanliness and infection had not yet been drawn, and although Sims was a man of scrupulously clean surgical habits, the constant exposure of the organic sutures to pathogens caused the women repeated infections. Sims, however, had a serendipitous inspiration. He decided to devise sutures of silver. Silver did not harbor pathogens, and the infections were finely tamed, allowing the possibility of healing. In the end, Sims triumphantly recorded closing Anarka's largest fingertip-size fistula. He announced that he had perfected the vesico-vaginal fistula operation in May of 1849, after scores of operations over 5 years, more than 30 operations on Anarka alone. In 1852, Sims's paper on vesico-vaginal fistula repair was published in the prestigious American Journal of the Medical Sciences. It made his national reputation. Sims became the celebrated father of American gynecology, and as such, his place in history was assured. W.J.S. McKay, M.D., spoke for his fellow surgeons in predicting that, when the history of modern gynecology is written, the work that Dr. Ephraim McDowell did will be represented as the dawn, and the first bright planet that appeared in the dim light of that dawn was Marion Sims. In the early 1850s, bouts with malaria forced Sims north to New York City, where he became a medical lion who built a society practice, did research with blacks and immigrant women, taught medicine, and held many influential positions in hospitals, medical societies, and in academe. He founded the New York Women's Hospital, the first hospital for women, which was built at Park Avenue and 50th Street, the present site of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Beginning in 1862, he also sojourned abroad, where his medical fame gave him entree into royal circles. He and his family became the toast of Second Empire Paris, while Sims attended the Empress Eugenie and other members of the French royal family. Across two continents, monuments, memorials, and clinics sprang up in his wake, including the one that now stands in New York's Central Park, all celebrating his stature as a physician treating alike empress and slave. Sims wrote copiously about his work and medical philosophies, as well as his life. In Alabama, Sims's vigorous defense of the slavery system had been liberally seasoned with nigger. However, once up north, he hid the ethnicity of his subjects, portraying them as white in the illustrations that accompanied his accounts of the surgery. His duplicitous praise of the indomitable courage of these long-suffering women failed to mention that it was chattel slavery and morphine, not courage, that had bound the women to his surgical table. Sims never disclosed whether he closed the fistulae of his other slave patients, although many who have written about him seem to take it as a matter of course that he did so. However, his erstwhile colleague Bozeman insisted that not one half of the slave women they worked upon together were afforded relief by the years of painful surgeries. Bozeman reported correcting some of the remaining fistulae himself, using a surgical innovation of button sutures, a technique he perfected by performing this procedure on other black slave women, Kitty, Dinah, and an unnamed mulatto girl. Bozeman even described a case of vesicovaginal fistula created by Sims when he removed the bladder stones of a 9-year-old slave girl. Sims was not pleased and used the New York Academy of Medicine as a bully pulpit to attack Bozeman for appropriating his technique. But Bozeman was not the only challenger to Sims's primacy as inventor of vesicovaginal fistula repair. In 1838, 15 years before Sims took up the problem, Virginia surgeon John Peter Medauer had devised a similar procedure, using lead rather than silver sutures. Medauer had operated on 25 women in Prince Edward County, Virginia, a large slaveholding area, but cured only one woman. Medauer blamed the slave women for his inability to help them. Speaking of one, he claimed, "I believe this case, nevertheless, could have been cured in the process of time, especially if sexual intercourse could have been prevented, which intercourse, I have no doubt, defeated several of the operations." Antebellum ethics. Sims was widely criticized not only by today's ethicists, but also by some 19th century contemporaries on medical and moral grounds. An intriguing 2003 New York Times essay observed, "Living in an era that uncritically celebrated white male doctors, the historians contended these writers had viewed Sims far too favorably." But the criticism is actually as old as Sims's surgeries. Some contemporaries were quite critical of his claims, and not only Bozeman, but also African-American physicians characterized Sims's surgeries as abuses. Cardiac specialist Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, who successfully performed one of the first open-heart operations, was an especially vocal critic. Williams was not born until 1858, years after Sims's vaginal repair surgeries were completed. But he studied and roundly condemned Sims and the continuing practice of performing surgery on unwilling black subjects. Williams also took Sims to task for pronouncements he continued to make about the sexual health and, by implication, the morality of black women. For example, Sims had reported that 60% of Negro women had uterine cancer, a disease then associated with early and frequent sexual contact, or uterine fibroids. Williams demanded proof, or at least evidence, but Sims had produced no raw data nor any investigative report to buttress this claim. Williams wondered in print how Sims could have determined this when black women were not permitted into white hospitals. Dr. W. Montague Cobb, another illustrious African-American surgeon, also vociferously opposed abusive experimentation with blacks, but he defended Sims. To refer to Anarka and the five other vesicovaginal patients whom Sims treated with her as human guinea pigs would be grossly unfair, as Sims continued to treat and provide for these girls at his own expense for 3 years in the little hospital in his yard, against enormous pressures from his family, the profession, and the public, one of the great humanitarian as well as scientific landmarks of American surgery. However, the women were held involuntarily for Sims's convenience, so requesting moral credit for lodging them is absurd. What's more, the women's lodging was not free. They did work without pay, and Sims did profit from the surgeries, whereas only Anarka seems definitely to have benefited from the 4 years of pain. Moreover, was the building to which Cobb referred really a hospital? A designation that implies that Sims's primary intent was to render medical care to his slaves? Sims is widely admired as the founder of the nation's first women's hospital. But this appellation refers to the more prepossessing structure on Park Avenue in New York City. If the New York structure housed the first women's hospital, then the Montgomery, Alabama slave quarters must have been something else, perhaps a laboratory that confined unwilling subjects. Cobb's defense of Sims shows that social class and varying ethical perceptions, not only race, have fueled this lengthy controversy. Whatever his true cure rate, Sims' silver sutures did help to end a real medical tragedy for many women, and some excuse the abuse of enslaved women on this basis. This essentially utilitarian argument presents an ethical balance sheet, with the savage medical abuse of captive women on one hand, and the countless women saved from painful invalidism on the other. However, such an argument ignores the ethical concept of social justice, and these experiments violated this essential value because the suffering and the benefits have been distributed in an unfair way, leading to distributive injustice. In this case, the most powerless group, which is also a racially distinct group and a captive group, is the group upon which doctors inflicted harm for the greater good. Another privileged group enjoys the benefits but shares neither the pain nor the risks. Thus, the moral unacceptability is clear. But the dangers of such practices are more shadowy. One danger of violating distributive justice is that this tends to perpetuate social inequities, and this is exactly what has happened with vesico-vaginal fistula. Today, as in the 19th century, the overwhelming majority of women who suffer from vesico-vaginal fistula are poor blacks without access to quality health care, women in sub-Saharan Africa. They do so because they share the same risk factors as Lucy and Anarka, malnutrition and poor perinatal care, and they have little access to surgeons who can repair their fistulas. The beneficiaries of the surgery today are many, but the same sort of women whose misery made the surgery possible are excluded. Sims's popular legacy reflects the face he turned to white women of his class, an image coined into enduring medical fame and gratitude. Only enslaved blacks, such as Lucy and Anarka, saw the hideous obverse of that coin, and history has silenced them. Whatever his ethical sins, Sims's surgical exploitation of enslaved blacks was consonant with the medical practice of his time. For black women, forced experimentation was the standard of care. A Donelson, Louisiana surgeon named Dr. Francois-Marie Prevost used enslaved black women to perfect cesarean sections, performing four such deliveries on them between 1822 and 1831. In 1830, he performed his first successful cesarean on a woman Prevost described as a fat-colored primipara, a woman giving birth for the first time, with a contracted pelvis. 29 of the subsequent 36 Southern surgical cases to duplicate and perfect the procedure were performed on black women. Prevost's contemporary, Dr. Ephraim McDowell, was the first to perform an ovariotomy, removal of an ovary, successfully, and he perfected this dangerous and excruciatingly radical surgery on his four slave women. McDowell performed his research in Kentucky, a state with very few African Americans. So did Dr. P.C. Spencer of Petersburg, Virginia, who devised a novel surgical procedure for bladder stones after equally painful surgical experimentation on slaves. The discoveries of Robert Jennings, who eventually invented typhoid vaccine, were also tested first on blacks. But what of other experimentation, that not described in professional journals and the halls of academe? African Americans have long circulated accounts of doctors who seized hapless blacks from the street to experiment on them. These accounts are usually derided as being paranoid. But consider this incident, originally described in a 19th century textbook on the history of anesthesia. In Anderson, South Carolina, in 1839, a group seized a black boy and forced him to inhale ether from a handkerchief that was held over his mouth and nose. Soon the boy became motionless and unconscious and was feared dead. However, after an hour he revived, no worse for his alarming experience. This incident convinced Dr. Crawford W. Long that ether could safely be tested as a potential anesthetic, as he did using three black slaves, followed by the amputation of an etherized boy's toe in 1842 and a man's finger in 1845. Another illuminating aspect of such incidents is how they differ from the conventional representations of experimentation. Robert Hinckley's The First Operation Under Ether, an oil painting that dominates one wall of Harvard's Francis A. Conway Library of Medicine, shows ether being administered to a supine white male attended by impeccably clad physicians in a theater holding tiers of enraptured doctors. This beautifully composed image evokes a sober atmosphere of reverent wonder, underscored by the somber tones and formal stances of the surgeons. Its grandeur has informed many a viewer's conception of the experimental investigation of ether, but it is an idealized rendering, rife with inaccuracies. Although it purports to depict the first use of ether as an anesthetic, it does not. This stately image is a beautiful fiction with a brutally factual negative. The body of a black slave seized by laughing medical thugs, forced to inhale ether, and left for dead in the road. Some who ascribe African-Americans' poor health to their wariness of the U.S. health system claim that African-Americans have always opposed medical experimentation independently of any medical abuses. But from an early time, black Americans themselves have engaged in therapeutic medical experimentation. African herbalists investigated, tested, and perfected the use of plants they found in the New World for the new ailments that afflicted both blacks and whites. They adapted medicines and techniques they brought with them, such as the stimulant kolanut, which was adopted so widely that it eventually supplied the main ingredient for Coca-Cola. In 1721, an enslaved African named Onesimus proposed a novel medical technique that saved the city of Boston from a dread smallpox epidemic and provided the first important medical advance in the New World. Onesimus, a pretty intelligent fellow, had been given to Cotton Mather, the Puritan preacher and amateur scientist, by a grateful congregation in 1706. Because a case of smallpox conferred complete lifelong immunity, slave dealers routinely advertised the fact, or the fiction, that a slave had survived a bout of the disease. Therefore, Cotton Mather soon asked his acquisition whether he had had smallpox. He answered both yes and no, and then told me that he had undergone an operation which had given him something of the smallpox and would forever preserve him from it, adding that it was often used among the Garamantes, and whoever had the courage to use it was forever free from the fear of contagion. Onesimus was speaking of inoculation against smallpox, a successful preventative measure that was widely practiced throughout Africa. Smallpox inoculation took various forms, but the common denominator was that a small amount of the pus in scabs or other infected matter from someone with smallpox was deliberately introduced into the broken skin of a well person. This variolation, as Mather called it, evoked mild symptoms, followed by permanent, complete immunity, the holy grail of smallpox prevention for Western doctors and scientists. Onesimus showed Cotton Mather the technique used by those in his native country. When a smallpox epidemic revisited Boston in the summer of 1721, Cotton Mather and his clerical brethren called for a mass inoculation of the people of Boston. However, the city's physicians, led by William Douglas, resented being told by a gaggle of ministers that Africans had devised the panacea they had long sought. Zabdiel Boylston was the only physician to embrace inoculation, but not before testing it on two black slaves, then 248 more, as well as his own six-year-old son. Boylston then proved that he had achieved immunity by exposing them to cases of smallpox. The physician's resistance turned uglier and violent. The popular press played no small role, serving as the battleground, while doctors condemned variolation because it was the laughable, unchristian product of occult African practices.
And that's where we will pick up at next week for study session number 3. We're almost at the end of the second chapter. We're actually making pretty good time with the book, so we might not be on this book quite as long as I originally thought. With that, if folks have commentary they would like to get in, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in the first time around should still be with us. Mr. Demery 4, Roz, Thomas in New York, our narrator from previous text. I believe this is Karma. I will start with the caller at 3666 just because we hadn't heard from you during the first session. I think this might be our caller in Ohio. Last four digits, 3666. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say that just listening to this story, this book, I mean, it's such a travesty of how we were experimented on and looked upon as just pure animals. And I think that the more this comes out, you know, the horrors, the absolute horrors of slavery and, you know, and what happened to us, it was not just, it's important to understand, it was not just about getting black people to work and pick cotton. It was about using and abusing our bodies, disrespecting us in life, disrespecting us in death, and just basically trying to take, you know, our humanity. And I think that it's important that these stories get out so that, you know, that our children and our grandchildren understand how despicable the system of racism, white supremacy was and is. And that was just the formal part of slavery. It was just one part of the system. And to understand that you cannot let these racist white people, or people who classify themselves as white, get any power over you, because they're just going to revert to doing that. They'll do it again. And I'm convinced of that. They are not to be trusted. And I'll go ahead and I'll mute my line.
Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you all had commentary, the line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
I was just listening.
Nobody had any other comments they wanted to get in on the second audio segment?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I was hesitating because this particular section is hideous, and it's very upsetting. But, you know, there's no limit to what, you know, these racists will do. We already know that, you know, they will mistreat black people at any cost, because they're killing blacks in the street now and paying millions of dollars to their families. And then it continues, you know, week after week and month after month. And so the last caller was speaking about humanity, trying to take our humanity, but I've come to the conclusion that whites are devoid of humanity themselves. That's what allows them to do the atrocities that they do upon black people and other non-white people. Because we're investigating, you know, atrocities to black people, but there were, it's just a endless, you know, line or amount of other non-white individuals that, you know, endured hideous experiments and malpractice, medical malpractice also. So it's just nothing surprises me anymore. You know, I used to be shocked and appalled, and now I'm almost numb. You could tell me that at one point they were cutting the heads off black people, and it wouldn't faze me. I wouldn't doubt it, you know, because it's just no limit to this. And then I can't even repeat, you know, some of the things that we just heard. It's just, you know, like the last caller said, you know, maybe this will get through to some people that whites have declared war against us and we are losing miserably. And when will it end? No one knows. We just have to continue to fight to replace white supremacy with justice. I'll mute my line.
For sure. Other folks that we haven't heard from, I was going to ask too, I should have said so earlier. Does it impact at all that this book, Medical Apartheid, authored by a black female, but the narrator, I'm not sure if it's a white person or a non-white person. I have to go back to double check. Sounds like it could be a white person, but does that any impact at all, or is that no influence at all as we move forward? The other folks who dialed in, I guess I'll check the caller at 9498, and then everybody else who chimed in also. 9498, did you have commentary?
Yes, I was just, thank you for taking my call. I was listening to the whole thing, but what really stood out to me is what they still say today, how we administer pain differently, how we're basically immune to pain. We don't feel pain the same as whites. I remember hearing that when they speak of the football players or whatever, basketball, whatever, those guys, when they speak of those guys, they say the same thing, that all their tolerance to pain is different. They always say that about us to this day, that our tolerance to pain is not the same as it's if we can take and endure that pain. And that's all I wanted to state, and sorry to chime in so late, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. That's certainly a long continuum. They have studies that, you know, have come out within the last year, months, weeks, with that exactly, and that's almost cliche that black people are not given pain medication or anesthesia at the same rates as whites. It's just assumed, and I think they even have other reports that they just think because they're just so accustomed to black people being punished and abused and molested that, you know, black people suffering is just, you know, no big deal. So why should we jump to alleviate any pain that a black person is feeling? Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, do y'all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low, Thomas, in New York. If you could speak up, please.
Yes, so can I be heard better now?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I had, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this is the piggyback on what was said earlier, because someone mentioned Obamacare, and you know, this book is about the healthcare system. Now, with all the blacks now getting Obamacare, you know, this pain management thing, if you look at what is addicting a lot of these white people, is they first become addicted to the painkillers. And then when they are no longer able to get the prescription or the painkillers have become too expensive, then they switch to the closest thing to it, which is heroin. And the fact that we haven't been getting these, we have this premonition that we have this high tolerance of pain. It's a lot of times where I know of black people that have gone to the doctor, they don't get prescribed the same painkillers as white people, and maybe that's been a sort of a blessing in disguise. And I think that a huge part of this Obamacare is going to be getting black people addicted to those painkillers now that, you know, the government will be paying for them somewhat, and it'll be cheaper to get, and, you know, it's big business. And you know, we already see where they're going with wanting to legalize all drugs. So I just think that that could be sort of one of those things that's going to happen as a result of the Obamacare, because I don't think white people do anything for our best benefit. This guy Sims, man, we talk about taking down the Confederate flag in Tillman. I mean, this guy has a statue in Central Park. And yeah, I'm really thinking about going to get on the train and take a hacksaw or something to it. I mean, it's just crazy. How I'm not crazy. I mean, this guy, I wonder if he was also sleeping with these women that he was doing these things to. I mean, it sounded somewhat like the Donald Goins type novel. You know, he strings them out on morphine, and getting them high, and they'll be coming back because they want their fix. And they, of course, if they don't have their morphine, they're going to get sick. And, come up here, put your legs up, let me do another procedure, and I'll give you your dose. I mean, just, pimping, like, I mean, and he gets credited with all these things, even though all white people, if this black lady was able to find out this information, all white people that study him know that. So they just don't care, they just don't care. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
For sure. Yep, we can hear you, Ross. Oh.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry about that. I didn't want to speak prematurely. First, I wanted to speak to the part of the last segment. You had brought up something about sexual leverage. I think you read a brief passage about that and discussed, I think in one of the books that you had read it from, that black women had some sort of leverage in the bedroom. And it brought up something. I'm not a big TV watcher, but there's a really pretty good program that John Legend executive produced called Underground, and it deals with slaves running away. And I remember there was a scene in which the female slave of a miscegenated union who was a house slave has three children, a very young black male, an adult black male, and then an adult daughter. And they show a scene of her in passionate sexual embrace with the slave owner, and she's actually doing it to protect her sons because of basically to protect them from abuse on the plantation. And I remember in that moment, she was kind of domineering of him in the scene, kind of telling him certain things she wanted him to do. And he would basically give in because he wanted her sexual favor. And then in a scene later on, a few episodes later, he wants to sleep with her again. And she's doesn't want to have sex with him. And it's because she's kind of dealing with the psychology of her daughter who ran away from the plantation and the search for them and all of this other stuff. So she really doesn't want to deal with that in the moment. And he just literally shuts down all of her her retorts against it and basically says, well, I'm in control. I could do what I want. And then eventually he does let her go. But it just speaks to the fact that we had no control, no control over our bodies in that way. And I think that it's just to see it play out in that way, I've never seen it play out so profound in a show. So, I mean, the research that was done in this program, I think, was pretty profound. But it just kind of speaks to what you talked about in the last segment. To get to this segment, wanted to comment first on Montague Cobb, the black doctor. He really did not understand racism, white supremacy, to actually praise Sims for anything that he did. It was kind of nauseating to even read what he said, but I can't judge him. He's a victim like I am. And obviously he was from an era in which I guess he was somewhat acclimated to the system and obviously did not understand it and not positively acclimated to the system either. But on page 60, Dr. Washington writes, as a seasoned politician, Jefferson knew that his experiments on slaves would be criticized and that they seemed at variance with his sympathetic statements about blacks. So he slyly used language to deflect possible criticism, referring to conducting experiments on some of my own family, without clarifying that the family, in quotes, in question consisted of slaves owned by himself and his son. I mean, just the masters of rhetorical ethic. And this kind of shows up throughout this reading, different people and their rhetorical ethics, including Mr. Sims as well. And I just found that passage very telling in the fact that it was dealing with Thomas Jefferson specifically. And, I found this really insane and extremely white supremacist. This is on page 62. It says, he took a sick black baby from its mother, made incisions in its scalp, then wielded a cobbler's tool to pry the skull bones into new positions. During this time, I would occasionally puncture the scalp over the lambdoidal suture with the point of a crooked awl and prise out the edges of the parietal bones, always with the effect of greatly modifying the rigid pleura of the extremities. Sim's attempt to open the skull was based upon a scientific myth that the bones of black infant skulls, unlike white infants, grew together quickly, leaving the brain no space to grow and develop. This premature closing of the black skull was held to cause low intelligence and perpetual childishness, in adult blacks. When the infants died, Sims castigated the sloth and ignorance of their mothers and the black midwives who attended them. Wow. Talk about sadistic. I read stories of our ancestors in Egypt doing trepanation and different types of brain surgery on soldiers in combat, and they had an extremely high success rate unless the person was fatally injured. So I can't imagine what these infants went through, being basically healthy black children who were being tortured, I mean medically tortured in ways that it's indescribable what was written here. And then for him to turn around and disrespect their mothers, white people are just functionally psychotic. And that paragraph just really speaks volumes to that. And then, here, she writes on page 64, historian Walter Fisher sums it up. It is most improbable that Sims and his assistant Bozeman could have established so remarkable a surgical schedule without the slave system, which provided the experimental subjects. Slaves did not have to be recruited, persuaded, and cajoled to endure pain and indignity. They could not refuse. It just speaks to the fact that, again, black men and women do not have control of our own bodies. I remember, I think you brought up the young brother when we were talking to Dr. Umar Johnson, that whose body was basically devoid of his organs and stuffed with newspaper. Just the things that happen to us on a daily basis, like we don't have control over our bodies. We can walk outside and be killed by a police officer or some white George Zimmerman-esque a U.S. citizen who will more than likely get away with it. We still today do not have control of our own bodies. And that that little piece there is just incredible, that the control was just so minimal to the point that they can literally just force you to be tortured and endure such incredible medical experimentation, and you could say nothing about it. It was almost nauseating to read. And then the section here where she says, Sims explained that opiate calms the nerves, inspires hope, relieves scalding of the urine, and permitted the patient doomed to a fortnight's horizontal position to pass the time with pleasant dreams and delightful sensations instead of painful forebodings and intolerable suffering. The morphine did ease recovery, but it did not allay the pain of the procedure itself. So this practice perplexed some of Sims' contemporaries. The most logical explanation is that this practice had more to do with controlling the women's behavior than controlling their pain, because the addiction weakened their will to resist repeated procedures. I will piggyback off of what Thomas in New York said. Sounds like Porky from Dope Fiend, Donald Goins. It just proves that not only are whites the original drug addicts, but they are the original drug dealers. With such forethought, think, give them opium so that they would be addicted, which makes it easier for me to terrorize them and use them as experiments. That it just gets no more psychotic than that, and it really gives an understanding to the forethought of whites when they choose to do something horribly racist, white supremacist to black people, that they literally think, like you said, not just 10 steps ahead of us, but 500 years ahead of us. And we have a lot of work to do in studying how they function so we can combat this and replace this system with justice. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Anybody that we have not heard from who had commentary they wanted to get in? Anyone we have not heard from?
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I wanted to say that Dr. Layla Africa, he did a piece on YouTube called he did a lecture, and it's on YouTube called European Medicine, History, Myth, and Lies. If you guys want to check that out, it talks about how so-called Europeans, white people, some of the experiments that they were doing on themselves, like leeching and, bleeding and just weird, you know, just crazy experiments they were doing on themselves is very interesting. And Dr. Gary Null, he's out of New York. He did a piece called Psychiatric Warfare Against Black People, where he talks about how black people, they go to seek psychiatric help and end up, you know, the back door opens up and they find themselves held without their held without their will, just for seeking psychiatric help. It's very interesting. I mean, it goes deep. And there's books on books about this type of stuff, you know, them experimenting on us. And I just wanted to say that Gus says all the time, you know, sometimes you hear black people say, yeah, they want to kill us all and things like that. And, you know, he always tells us, you know, like, you know, reminds us that they could have killed us all long, you know, they have the technology to kill all black people, non-white people. But in a war, why do you take captives, really? You know what I mean? Like, why not kill them all? Why do you take you kill a gang of them, and then, you know, you take some captives back to, you know, your camp or your city or whatever, for what? You know, you want to get information about, you know? So this is what's going on. So it shouldn't be any surprise, and that's why I wanted to bring out that Layla Africa part. Is so when you see the thing that they did to themselves, you know, what was that, Dutch or something like that? Anyway, they would have like date nights where you would go watch a autopsy in Europe. you know, you get. I mean, they would dress to the nines. Like these were so called high class people, man. You know what I'm saying? They had servants putting their clothes on for them, and they would go take their woman to a autopsy. So I mean, you know, like this is war. Like I keep saying it. But another thing I wanted to, I could remember, Gus. I remember we were talking about, I think it's called Ibogaine or Ibogaine. We were saying that, we were talking about how like this black person had ended up told this white woman at a lecture that this particular, I think it's like a root or a plant in Africa called, the modern term is Ibogaine, or it might even be an African word, that it really does these, you know, miracle types of things, you know, when you take it. And she ignored him at the time, you know, like he was just some nigger in the audience. She couldn't even remember his name as she recounted that event or whatever. And she ended up later finding out that this Ibogaine was, you know, had all these properties and stuff. And now she made her fortune with the particular with the particular plant or whatever. And so I just wanted to ask Gus, like, what do you think about that type of? What do you think about that? The fact that they will deny a truth and come up with any type of reason, you know, oh, it's not Christian, or, you know, if it's from a black person or anything like that, they can come up with anything, even any type of excuse, even when it's, you know, risking lives of white people, that how they can find, like, you know, they could just say it's not Christian. That's why they won't do it. I mean, this is something that they do and really, like, will ridicule you. They will have you fired. They'll find some way if it's coming from a black person. And they, you know, what do you think about that? I think you pretty much get what I'm saying.
I mean, that's white supremacy. You know, we're in charge. I don't even have to give a reason. I don't even have to say that it's because you're not Christian or because you're too short or because you're too dark. I don't even have to say that. I could just say no and not even give a reason. They do that quite often as well. And then they might wait a year or 5 years or 5 minutes and come back and take exactly what you said and just take credit for it and say, oh, yes, we just made a new discovery. And I'm going to make a lot of money off of this, or I'm going to put I'll win a prize. I'll get a Nobel Award or whatever the case may be. for something that you just said that I told you, you know, was the most ignorant thing in the history of ever. And I might even put you in jail because you said that. I mean, that's the system of white supremacy that we have. I think we see that demonstrated on a pretty, at least I see it demonstrated on a pretty regular basis. That's what it means when you have total domination.
That's right, man. Thank you for reminding us, man. This is what it is. You're totally dominated. And I will say this, man. I've heard stories from females in my family, man, of them. I'm sorry, Gus, you were breaking up. I started talking. I thought you were finished. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Were you talking? Because we couldn't hear you. Because you act like clicked in and then it went out.
I pretty much answered. That was my response.
Oh, so. Yeah. I was just going to say, yeah, thanks for reminding us of that. You know what I'm saying? But I was going to say again that, you know, people in my family, I've heard stories about how doctors experimented on them. And they found out later that that procedure that they had was just some, you know, complete garbage that was really like, you know, there was no reason for it other than, you know, an experiment. Let's see what will happen to you if I, you know, buy in your breast or whatever. Man, what was I gonna say? Oh, educate your people. This is for educating your people, the young people, and talk to these old people, and I guarantee you they will tell you if they had any encounter, especially females, because they love going to the doctor, talk to them, and they'll have some horror stories of their own. So, you know, educate, you gotta educate use this for education, the youngsters, so they won't be, everybody, man, anybody that you can, educate them about this so they won't, psychiatry, everything, man. Like, you're going to be experimenting on going to these particular things and talk to the elders. And I think that you'll be surprised if you haven't already heard these stories. You'll be surprised of how many family members have been experimented on in a gross way. Thank you for the book, Gus.
For sure. Looking forward to continuing to read. I think I put that in the description for pretty much all the, well, we've only done two, but for the two sessions that we've done thus far, that this book should be required reading for all black people. And particularly if you're a black person and you say, hey, I'm serious about counter-racism and solving this problem like ASAP. This is definitely a book that you should be devouring. Some of the things that stood out that I made note of from the second audio, so, or I guess I'll get in since Obamacare was mentioned with the prescription drugs. Not all black people even have access to that, because you had a sizable number of white people, because you had a feature where you could opt out and say states could opt out of it and say, well, we reject these federal dollars and we're not going to participate in Obamacare. You had a sizable chunk of white people, particularly in states where you have high populations of black people, where they rejected Obamacare. So not all black people in the states have the same access to Obamacare because of racism, white supremacy. And that's directly what it was tied to, where you had white people who might classify themselves as Republican or whatever, who say, hey, that nigga Obama put this plan out and we're not going to have anything to do with it. And I don't care. And there were even white people who were saying that this would be a great benefit to our state, because we do have even a lot of white people that don't have adequate health care and this might help them to some degree. But we're not going to do it because that nigga put this plan out. That's it. Some of the things that stood out in the second portion, I thought it was great that I didn't hear anybody say anything about the narrator. Look, the narrator is Ron Butler, and looks like he is a non-white male, black male, definitely a non-white male. But still, I didn't really hear anybody. Didn't seem like anybody had any issues or concerns about this book being narrated by a male author. Looks like a non-white male author or non-white male narrator, as opposed to in relation to it being written by a black female. I really appreciated where she wrote, this is in chapter 2, the experimental abuse of African Americans was not a cultural anomaly. It simply mirrored in the medical arena the economic, social, and health abuses that the larger society perpetuated against people of color, especially in the slave-holding states. That is the system of white supremacy. This is par for the course. Marion J. Sims, or J. Marion Skim, excuse me, he does not just have that statue in Central Park, as I pointed out. He has statues in South Carolina, statues in Alabama. If you're going to get your hatchet and go to Central Park, then you're also going to have to make a trip south to those spots as well. It would not surprise me if he, or in fact, I'd be surprised if he does not have statues in other places as well, when we talk about all the monuments and what have you that they have to the system of white supremacy. When we talk about masters of deception, and particularly white people with their skillful use of words, I think I have in the description that a lot of this information about the mutilation and abuse of black people under the guise of medical research or science, that a lot of times it's disguised with highfalutin words. Whites do that a lot with racism, period, but they can especially get away with that under the guise of science, because it'll just be, oh, well, you're just too dumb. See, that's just, you got your little puny Negro brain, you're just not intelligent enough to understand what I've written in this here book. See, that's why I'm so smart, because I'm a white expert and you're just a dumb Negro. That's why we're supposed to dominate you forever. And that's not it at all. That they have just purposely wrote this in a very convoluted manner to disguise that they're practicing racism. And I love that she pointed that out repeatedly, whether it was J. Marion Sims doing this, whether he obscures leaving out the racial classifications of the black people, where he had no problem when there was no scrutiny of this, nigger that, yep, did this to these nigger women, did this to this negress, no problem. Then when there might be some questioning, some scrutiny about this, oh, I'll just leave it out, or I might even make it seem that I just did this to all white people. I think he noted the same thing with Thomas Jefferson, rapist, racist. He points out the same thing where he makes it seem, oh, I just, you know, tried this out on some of my family members and voila, it worked, as opposed to just being honest. These are black people that I have enslaved and I'm raping, that I went and tried these experiments out on and they didn't die. So it looks like this might have worked out. So now, you know, use this on white people. Let's see. Some of the other things that stood out. Well, and the lying, I think that's something that stood out just in the first 2 weeks that we've done this, where she says this successful experiment on enslaved population defies all logic because smallpox vaccine is not efficacious against typhoid. One cannot be certain whether serendipity or outright fraud was involved, but the mathematical odds against such results arising by luck are staggering, and no one has ever successfully duplicated Jennings' experiment, where he claims that he used some sort of smallpox vaccine, and this was able to successfully work against someone being contaminated or contracting typhoid. White people just lie, and I think she pointed that out, that you had all these major institutions, some of them Ivy League institutes, where they were caught lying and committing fraud in their different research and saying that they had achieved these results or achieved this result, and nothing could be further from the truth. I think this came up with Henrietta Lacks as well. Well, whites, they just lie all the time, and that's something else that you can get away with a lot if you're in a position of power, where you can just lie, particularly when you have people terrorized, where they cannot question you, where they cannot point out and say, well, hey, I think, you know, some of this is not making sense. I don't know, hey, we'll just beat you down, fire you, whatever the case may be, because we are in charge. I think you all already pointed out some of the abuses that were committed against black children. This is ongoing. I also thought it was important that white people, these unsanitary conditions, malnutrition, the terrorism and the toll that that takes on you mentally, spiritually, physically, as opposed to white people being blamed. Once again, black people get blamed, where they say the passage here, Sims' attempt to open the skull was based on a scientific myth that bones of black infant skulls, unlike white infants, grew together quickly, leaving the brain no space to grow and develop. This premature closing of the black skull was held to cause low intelligence and perpetual childness in adult blacks. When the infants died, Sims castigated the sloth and ignorance of their mothers and the black midwives who attended them. This is 2016. You still see this type of racist language employed to abuse, admonish, particularly, I would say, black mothers, black parents in general, that, oh, that's why we need our officer slam in the school, because you just can't take care of your children. That's the problem. You all are too busy running around with your crack pipes and buying your Jordans to take care and raise your children. That's the problem. Ongoing racist trope for centuries now. Let's see. Oh, man, we got this. Dorothy Roberts, she was mentioned in the book last week, her book, Killing the Black Body, phenomenal. Another one that I would say should be in the top 10 required reading for black people. She was on the program in 2009 and has been a three-time guest on The Cows, where Harriet Washington, she writes, as terrible as Anacra's condition was an enslaved black female. A certain hyperbole entered Sims' description of it. He compared it to smallpox and stressed its unpleasantness for spectators, as well as the fact that it made her unfit for work. From a planter's perspective, made her unfit for work. And this was where she had all these tears in her vaginal region, and it was causing her to be incontinent. She was leaking urine, and just where you end up with a situation where you have the stench from it, also where she ends up with an infection and just the pain of all of this. Dorothy Roberts picked up on that and says, well, what do you mean unfit for work? What about this would make you unfit for work? Because, I mean, you have no regard for her being in some sort of pain or discomfort around all this. I mean, who cares? Get out there and pick that cotton or whatever other tasks we have planned for you. And Dorothy Roberts, she said, no, when they say unfit for work, this means because you have these vaginal tears, and because you're incontinent and you're leaking urine and what have you, this means that you are not fit for me to rape you at this particular point in time. That's what they're talking about. And that's one thing that I would say is already sticking out, that in the midst of all of this phenomenal information in this book, the perpetual rape of black females, constant. I'd say that's another thing that gets buried right in plain sight. It's right there, and people just don't want to be honest. They just don't want to point that out, that this is one of the fundamental aspects of racism, white supremacy, not just during the earlier period of plantation slavery, but, I mean, this is just ongoing, necessary. One of the things that white people look forward to and put tops on the list of doing, make sure you rape black people, not just the females, all black people. Let's see, last two things I had before finish things up. Oh, yeah, just bears repeating. Historian Walter Fisher sums it up. It is most improbable. I think one of you all even referenced this point where black people just had no ability to say no, to refuse. That, I would assert, remains the system of white supremacy. I think this is my third Daniel Holtzclaw reference. Some of his black victims said that exactly. Armed white man, how could we refuse? The last thing, let's see. Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, this reveals also a lot about white culture, what it means to be white. When he says Sims attended white women patients who suffered from vaginismus, a disorder marked by painful vaginal muscle contractions that prevent the entrance of the penis, making intercourse impossible, complaining husbands approached Sims, who regularly etherized their wives, rendering them unconscious so that their husbands could have sex with them. Might give slightly better understanding for why you have so many white sexual perverts and terrorists, whether it's Daniel Holdsclaw, Jerry Sandusky, long list of this behavior that is just celebrated, even if it's raping other white people. Who cares? This is a part of what we do. And Dr. Wellesley would point out the disregard for sexual intercourse. But yeah, this is my wife, and she's having some medical discomfort, but I don't care about that. Just knock her out so that I can have sex and enjoy myself. That is white culture, what it means to be white, I would submit as well. There was one more thing I was going to get in because I thought it was significant as well, since we're talking about the lying, where they talk about just snatching up a random black child on the street and using ether on him, and he gets knocked out and they just leave him in the ditch, and then he wakes up like, oh, great, this works. We can use this for white people. Outstanding. And she compares that to the gigantic portrait, which is a total lie, that is allegedly supposed to be the first time that they use ether in a medical sense, as a form of anesthesia, that this is a total lie. Whites do this all the time. The bigger the portrait, the bigger the fantasy, the bigger the lie. They get away with this on a constant basis. They use this method. When Mr. Fuller, when we talk about master deceiver, this is the sort of thing that we're talking about. And again, this is an Ivy League institute. This is supposed to be one of the, you know, greatest places in the universe that you could go and get education about all sorts of things. And they, too, intricately involved in spreading massive lies about their own history of barbarism, terrorism, savagery against black people. We don't want to have a picture of a gang of white thugs kidnapping a black child and drugging him and leaving him in a ditch somewhere. We don't want to put that up on the halls of Harvard, which would be truthful, which would be an accurate understanding of the history, the evolution of medical research, science, racism, white culture in this part. No, we don't want to put that up. Let's, you know, see if we can concoct some nonsense and put that up on the wall and allege that that is the truth. And I will stop there. I suspect it'll be more of this sort of thing as we roll. Anybody have a last comment before we get in, or everyone satisfied? If we missed anybody, I guess you should go. But anybody had a final comment they wanted to get in?
Yeah, she made one reference to privilege, I thought. And also, the part when it was read during the book, and then when Vaz also read that same portion with the baby and the skull, it just automatically what popped in my head was the episode with the alligator babies. You know, I don't know why I made that correlation, but when he read it again, that's the first thing that popped in my head. And I'll meet my mom. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. Great reading, folks. I said this last week. I think if folks have observations, I know a lot more people listen to the archives. If you anything sticks out, something you want to share, you can drop an email, and we'll share it on the program. Next week, great observations from all the folks who tuned in and anyone interested on this particular subject matter. We've done quite a few programs that discuss this very same topic, same material. As I said, Dorothy Roberts, Killing the Black Body, Vernelia Randall, she was in the introduction this week, Dying While Black, same sort of information, James Jones, Bad Blood about the Tuskegee Syphilis experiment, even Dorothy Roberts, again, Fatal Invention, where she's talking about some of these same issues in a more contemporary sense, things that are happening right now, 21st century. And it's even more than that. I'd say this is a topic that we have covered pretty well throughout the years that we've been on the program. You can hear it over a continuum from 2009 all the way up to now. Alan Hornblum, Sentenced to Science and Acres of Skin, he was on the program 2014 also. If you can't find something in the archives, drop an email. We'll let you know, help you find it. With that, we should be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in. We'll catch up on news, observations, the last 7 days, workplace racism, certainly. Looking forward to hearing from everybody. Again, you can follow us on Twitter at Until Justice, Facebook, facebook.com/ The Problem Is White People. With that, I will say again, and I mean particularly with what we've got in this book, understanding that whites are waging war against us is no time for us to be drunk, high, not thinking clearly about what is happening to us and alert to our surroundings at all times. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, particularly if you're going to be out and about. I know the weather's getting warm. It's going to be May soon. Man, you do not want to be intoxicated behind the wheel. That's driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian. You never know when it'll be Daniel Pantaleo, Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers. You never know when they will be the ones pulling you over. And your life could be on the line, depending on you making phenomenal decisions to keep yourself as safe as possible and any other victims of racism. So keep that in mind. And I just, again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Also, buckle up if you're going to be in a vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with enforcement officers. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.